I have a quick apology for those people who have been hearing a lot of me on Coast to Coast AM these days. My service here has been a joy to me, but I realize that probably time for some other voices on Coast to Coast, so I will say this will be my last night of three that I've had the chance to be on. The last two, we did the annual Coast to Coast AM prediction shows, and I sat in and did those. Looking forward to doing the follow-up a year from now on your predictions on the air on Coast to Coast. And we're going to follow that theme a little bit tonight, but do it a little differently, in that we're going to talk about the future. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things we'll be seeing in 2011, but more just about being a futurist. We'll talk about the trajectories of technologies, of social change, of economies, and how you can benefit from taking a longer range view of how you will be impacted by the future. The future's coming. And surprisingly, except for around this time of year when people reflect back on their individual and oftentimes our kind of collective futures, most people don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the future. They say things like, well, the future will take care of itself, which to some sort of passive degree is always true. But for people who are more interested in actively participating in shaping the future, and we're being prepared for those things that are coming so that they might be able to better take advantage of them, profit from them, make sure that they're not a victim of them anyway. Future studies is something which is just getting traction. And it is, I think, really, if you'll pardon the expression, kind of the college major of the future. And we'll get into some of the people who were involved with it, both academically and as professional futurists. We'll talk about some of these long trends that are coming, some of these movements that are already underfoot, or some which may be thought of as coming but haven't appeared yet, too. We'll do that with the many people who were involved with the studies, and for that matter, the education of futures, and professionally guide major corporations in being prepared for the future changes that are going to affect everybody's bottom line. Coming next hour on Coast to Coast. Coming up this hour, before I explain why we have Galen Cook coming up, I'll mention that Captain Kelly Sweeney's coming on for a few minutes in just a minute to talk about a very tragic but fascinating story again in this ongoing narrative we've been covering about waves. You know, the belief in rogue waves is a fairly recent one. Science was very skeptical for a long time. And rogue waves really didn't get its first major breakthrough book until 2010. And we talked about the Susan Casey book, both with her and outside of her and other conversations, about people who have been really both studying and seeing how frequently these massive killers have been out on the ocean. Be long before human beings ever saw them, before they ever recorded, before we were ever affected by them. And now, since they've been verified, now we catch them all the time. Like a lot of things, these killer wave stories pop up from time to time. And this one isn't just a tragedy in terms of it, you know, what it can do to shipping lanes or cargo, but also a killer wave story that involves the captain. And it happened fairly recently, and Captain Kelly Sweeney, who is sort of our ongoing correspondent on all maritime issues, will come on and explain that in just a minute. And then Galen Cook, who comes on to talk about D.V. Cooper, too, this hour. But again, let me set that up by saying this. Over the last couple of nights, I mentioned that I've been sort of still recovering from a couple of medical things over the last, couple of months. But specifically in December, I had two surgeries. One I'll save for later, but I had an ankle that I tore all of the ligaments on. I posted a photo a couple of Saturdays ago about my foot in a cast, and they put a screw through my ankle to hold all the bones back together again. And I've been treated for that. Well, after about 8 days of having this cast on, I had to get it off. I had been watching, feeling that something was going on in the cast. It's just, you know, my dog kept coming up to the cast and he would just sniff the cast and he'd look at me like he was a cadaver dog. Something was going on in there. I could tell, I knew something was wrong too. And I had eczema, and I thought, well, it's probably something like that. Well, when they opened up the cast, I won't go into the horrific medical details, but my foot looked like something you'd see in those abnormal medical journals. So I've had to, since that happened Thursday, and since then I've been in and out of doctor's care for this foot to make sure I don't lose it. So, yeah, I did the two coast-to-coast shows on Thursday and Friday night because, well, I knew I was going to be up anyway. These treatments require a long time of sitting, so I thought I might as well be sitting and doing coast-to-coast. And also because the foot was not close to, well, I don't know how close to gangrene it was getting, but it was at least salvageable, and that was good news. And I was afraid if they found out that I was having a problem like this, they wouldn't let me do the show. So I kind of kept it to myself. But now I can tell you because it's Saturday and they can't keep me off now. But after all of that, the only reason I wanted to mention to you was for two reasons. So I'm on this antibiotic treatment to save the foot. And steroids and then your standard sort of amoxicillin thing. And then this other antibiotic, which I find out it's what they give to anthrax victims. So, you know, that'll get your attention a little bit when you're looking at it. This is what they give to people who have anthrax. This is how close things are getting there for a while. But it's all going to be fine. And I regret nothing that I've done. Sure wish that sort of thing didn't happen, but it does happen from time to time when people have casts. Assuming that everything works out for the best. So, and the other thing is I'm totally homebound. Fortunately, I have a radio studio in the house. I can't even leave the upstairs. I mean, I'm sort of trapped in a very nice prison, but I'm trapped. And I'm watching a lot of television. And I happen to see an upcoming ad for Brad Meltzer's Decoded. On the History Channel. Now, I don't know much about this show other than what I see the promos for, and I'm familiar with his work a little bit. So I was kind of curious to see what there's going to be like when the episode runs this Thursday about D.B. Cooper. And D.B. Cooper is a story we've been following for a long time on Coast to Coast. So I asked Galen Cook to come in and explain, give you a little preview of what might be on this show, for whatever it's worth. And he not only told me that our timing was impeccable in that he had something to say about the material they were focusing on in this History Channel show, which runs this coming Thursday, but also that he was just about to get in touch with me in that there were some revelations that he's willing to come out early on some letters that the prime suspect that was developed through this show, Coast to Coast, that some letters that our prime suspect had written are back on the table again and being examined. And we'll talk about that. You'll hear that for the first time coming up later on this hour. Big night ahead. Future Waves. We'll start next with Captain Kelly on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so enough said about my festive holiday season. Let's bring up Captain Kelly Sweeney, who is here to talk about something a little bit more tragic. But let me just start by saying Happy New Year, Captain Kelly.
Ahoy, Ian, to you and all the Coast listeners. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's nice to have you on, although I hate this type of story. We were we're not surprised that there are killer waves out there, but usually it doesn't come in a fashion like this, which seems like it needs a little bit more explanation. So I'll ask you to take it from the top on the story you sent me the link to earlier today. The death of a particular sea captain.
Yes. Well, the first maritime story of the year, Ian, is unfortunately one of death. And it's a reminder to everyone of the dangers that merchant mariners face to bring all of us the things that we need to live. In this particular accident, the name of the ship is the Aegean Angel. It's 900 feet long, and it was going from Estonia to Houston, and was 800 miles northeast of Bermuda on Thursday. Now, for the last few days, the ship had been taking a pounding in a winter storm. But on Thursday, the weather eased down to what we call a force 8, which is a gale force wind of around 40 miles an hour, much improved over a winter storm. And on a cargo ship, During a storm, all hands remain inside, just as a matter of safety. But it's standard procedure that when the weather slackens, the captain, chief engineer, and quite often the chief mate, will go out on deck to survey any damage that the ship may have taken during the storm. And these professional mariners, the captain was 47, chief was 33, and the mate was 34. They're seasoned professionals. And they take a look at the weather. It's calmed down from a storm down to a gale. And they're on a 900-foot ship. They decide to go out and take a look out on deck.
And I want to jump in just to ask you, what's the difference between a storm and a gale in ways that we might be able to relate more easily? Because we often use gale and storm to be kind of to be synonymous in common parlance.
The short version is there's a Beaufort scale at sea that starts at zero and goes up to 12 plus that basically describes wind and sea conditions on the water. A gale has a commensurate general wave height, usually 18 to 25 foot, and 39 to 46 knots, and a knot's a little more than a mile an hour, so it's about 40 miles an hour. A storm is over at least 65 miles an hour, and the seas could be easily 45 or 50 foot in a storm, depending on how long the storm's been blowing and how deep a low pressure it is. So the scale, what we're talking about here, gale and storm are not interchangeable. They're, a gale is a milder sea and wind condition than is a storm.
Yeah.
And so when the skipper and the chief and the mate saw that things had improved, they went out on deck to take a look at the damage. They were up on the bow.
Of a 900-foot ship, so how high above the waterline is a 900-foot ship like that?
Well, it's a tanker, and tankers, and it was loaded. It's loaded with fuel oil, basically diesel oil, diesel type oil, and so a tanker rides low in the water, so it's not going to be like a cruise ship. It has many, many decks out of that you can see above the waterline.
Right.
But I would say that on this size ship, 900 foot, I would say down to the waterline loaded would be at least, 35 feet.
Okay, so not
35 feet.
So still the distance maybe of a three-story building between the waterline and the deck.
Correct. I mean, okay. I mean that's a ballpark figure depending on whether it was a full load
Fair
or
enough.
Not. But that's a good
Fair
general
enough.
Look at it. Yes.
All right, we're talking with Captain Kelly Sweeney about an incident that happened just recently.
Yes.
Hate to start the year off with a tragedy like this, but it should be a good reminder to all of us, though, too, about how dangerous it is out on the seas for anybody because of what happens next.
Yes, because they were on the bow, and out of nowhere, this huge wave washes over the bow, what we call green water over the bow. It's not like you're plowing into it and you have spray coming back on deck. This is green ocean water rolling over the bow of the ship. It slams into the vessel and crushes the captain and the chief engineer to death. The chief mate sustained severe head wounds, but luckily is still alive.
Now, it's just one wave. So not a series of waves, just out of where they had already been able to see sort of a pattern of the waves.
Correct.
But out of that just comes from nowhere this green water wave. So if we can imagine that, this is not something that curled over on top of them.
Where no.
Right. So what would it have looked like if as they looked up for that last second before the wave hit, what would it have looked like?
Well, I think the closest thing would have been when you had that Gallon who wrote that book about rogue waves and some of those unbelievably, in my opinion, crazy surfers who were doing 100-foot
right.
waves
sure.
in Hawaii. It would look like a four-story high wall of water. If you were sitting down, a four-story high wall of water washing over your head.
And it'd be like, literally, it'd be like there over your head and then on top of you. It'd be like a four-story building just falling over on your
head.
Yeah,
and the water, of course, the water washes through as the ship's plowing through there. And so it not only does it have the motion of the vessel that makes it, but now you have this huge, in my opinion, it was a rogue wave. Now, they haven't verified that, because rogue waves have a certain definition, you know, twice the size of the average significant wave height of the normal waves. But I think that the size of this thing was described, in my opinion, it very, very likely that it was a rogue wave. And it crushed it slammed the captain into something on deck. I don't know what. You know, there's all kinds of equipment
sure.
on deck, valves,
right.
Right. valves and everything. It smashed him, crushed him and the chief engineer to death. The chief mate lived, thank goodness, and but you know, there is no doctor on board a cargo ship, so the crew has been tending to his wounds with guidance that they get from a doctor ashore over the satellite phone. Tomorrow, the Coast Guard's going to medically evacuate the chief mate to Bermuda, to a hospital. And Monday, the ship itself is scheduled to arrive in Bermuda. And they're going to get a new captain, a new chief engineer, a new chief mate. And they're going to take off and head over to Houston and finish the trip.
So this is a Greek-owned ship. Again, the Aegean Angel is what we were talking about.
Right.
And you're hearing about it here on Coast to Coast because... the death of the captain and the chief engineer. How rare is this?
Well, it's not as rare as you might think. I went to school with a guy who was a chief officer on a tanker up in Alaska, and he died when he got washed overboard during a heavy storm in the Gulf of Alaska. And earlier this year, there was some cargo operations. The Military Sealift Command has ships that use civilian mariners to replenish Navy ships at sea. They pass over fuel and
right.
supplies. And they were having a practice exercise around 75 miles off the coast of Virginia. And a rogue wave slammed into both these ships. They were 2 football fields long, each of them. And 4 crew members were severely injured and had to be medically evacuated. The Atlantic's a rough area, and it seems very interesting that the number of rogue waves, there was a cruise ship that got hit earlier this year. It seems
right.
that in the Atlantic there's been a proliferation of rogue wave incidents lately.
Well, and so maybe that's the question, are there more rogue waves happening now, or now that we have a name for them, now we have a way of defining them, and now we have captains who are willing to say this is what it was, because for a long time, captains were not taken seriously because mainstream science and academia hadn't accepted the existence of rogue waves.
That's true. You know, when I first started going to sea, I started on deck years ago, and the captain, my first captain was an old-timer, and he had been sailing up and down the West Coast on freighters. He was at the wheel on a ship, and a rogue wave came off of Coos Bay, Oregon, and it was so big that it slammed into the wheelhouse windows, and it broke the windows, and it had bended shards of glass into his head. And luckily, he lived through it. He was a hard-headed old guy.
Yeah, really?
Good guy. He was a good guy, too, but he had a hard head, thank goodness. But anyway, so I think, personally, you're absolutely right. Rogue waves have been happening, I think, you know, for as long as the oceans have been there, but I think we're just becoming aware of them, and they've gone from the realm of stories to reality. And unfortunately, these two men died, you know.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. It will be the first of many maritime stories to be appearing on Coast to Coast. Thank you so much for keeping an eye on that for us, and I look forward to it being a healthy new year for you when you get back out in the open sea.
Thank you, my friend. I just renewed my license. And you know, natural forces like this at sea are dangers all mariners face, but I wanted to pass on to the Coast listeners that man-made ones are also there. 26 ships and over 600 of my fellow mariners are being held hostage at gunpoint off the coast of Somalia right now by pirates, and so I hope their new year ends up well, too, Ian. I wish you and all the listeners a happy new year, Ian. Smooth sailing until we talk again.
And to you. And a good reminder on the piracy. Thank you. There's amazing stories tonight on coasttocoastam.com, the website. I just sent over the link for that story there about the rogue wave hitting this Greek tanker, so you get more details. And then there's also the story about the dead birds that just were falling from the sky. This is not an urban legend. This is an ongoing story, a current investigation that has led nowhere so far. There is no scientific theory that explains why thousands of blackbirds, mostly blackbirds, by the way, one duck, just fell starting almost at exactly the same time in a confined area. You'll see that story, too, if you go to coasttocoastam.com. Coming up in just a minute, a story of an old crime that gets revisited on this show because we think we're close to finally naming who was D.B. Cooper. Well, that is to say, getting the FBI to confirm that we've named the right guy. Coming up next on Coast to Coast. Well, some things change come New Year's, and that's what we're going to be talking about next hour on Coast to Coast, the future. It is said regularly that the top jobs in 2015 haven't been invented yet. So just if you have a kid who's heading into high school or going off to college, you have grandchildren, you're worried about what they're going to do for a living, well, you might want to keep on listening to Coast to Coast. Maybe you're one of those people who've been looking at your career going, you know, it just doesn't work for me. So what will be these new trends, both in our economy, our collective economy, and our personal economies? What are the big changes that are on the way? These deep trends, long-range forecasts, that's the work of futurists. And we'll be talking about that next hour on Coast to Coast with four professional futurists who we'll have on, including your calls in the last hour on Coast to Coast. But first, maybe you've seen the promos for it on the History Channel. This new series Brad Meltzer has out called Decoded. Wish him the best of luck with that. Love shows like that. And I saw that in the show coming up on January 6th, it starts with an investigation into D.B. Cooper. So right away, I fired off an email to our friend Galen Cook, lawyer in Seattle, who's been trying to track down the true identity of D.B. Cooper for years, and with the help of this show, came up with a prime number one suspect, which is only within the last year or so really gotten respect from the FBI. So what's going to be on this Brad Meltzer show? What is really going on in the true case of the investigation into D.B. Cooper? And what are these new letters that were recently rediscovered? We'll tell you all about that next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Galen Cook is a lawyer and an investigator in the case of D.B. Cooper, who has appeared regularly on Coast to Coast. We put our usual coasttocoastam.com file up that links up to this ongoing story so people can follow the arc of this from the very beginning at coasttocoastam.com. Just go to the little part there about tonight's show, and you can read on along with Galen Cook. Hey, Galen, how you doing?
Ian, Happy New Year to you and the entire Coast audience.
Well, good. Glad to have you back, and glad that there's some really fun, new, interesting developments going on in the D.B. Cooper case, because when I contacted you, it was just kind of a whim because I was too impatient to wait until Thursday to find out whether or not you were involved in this Brad Meltzer's Decoded debut on the History Channel. So explain what you know about what's going to be on this show.
Okay, and Ian, I just once again want to thank you for keeping Coast to Coast interest high on this D.B. Cooper case. You've been a great asset to the case, and I want to thank you.
I'm OCD when it comes to DBC. I'm going to make T-shirts that say I'm OCD on DBC.
Well,
you know, actually, why don't you take 2 minutes to explain for people who just aren't familiar with D.B.
Sure.
Cooper? Just do a quick, you know, thumbnail timeline.
Sure. I can do it in a minute. And by the way, I want to also let you know we were on the show a year ago, and you asked me at the time if maybe in 2011, which is the 40th anniversary of the D.B. Cooper case, if maybe we'd finally have it solved. And I'm going to tell you tonight that 2011 is the year D.B. Cooper will be solved.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I still want to be there for the press conference. I'll be standing in the back. I just want to be there to see the moment. So,
well, we'll bring you out front. D.B. Cooper was the name given to a skyjacker. Very notorious skyjacker, November 24th, 1971, hijacked a Northwest Orient Airlines 727 commercial jetliner out of Portland, Oregon. And his ransom demands were quite simple. I want four parachutes and $200,000 in U.S. currency awaiting at the airport in Seattle. And and then I'll release all 36 passengers on board. Those demands were met. The plane took off at about 7:40 p.m. that night out of Seattle with D.B. Cooper, the skyjacker, the three pilots up front, and one flight attendant, Tina Mucklow. And Cooper's directional demands were for the crew to fly the plane to Mexico. They told Cooper that the 727 didn't have enough range to make it to Mexico without at least one refueling stop, and could they make it at Reno, Nevada? Cooper said yes. When the plane landed in Reno, Nevada, about 11 p.m. that night, the FBI stormed the plane. The hijacker was gone. And to this day, there's never really been anything significantly found except for about $6,000 worth of some of D.B. Cooper's money that was discovered along the banks of the Columbia River about 10 miles west of Vancouver, Washington. It's a very strange cold case that the FBI has never been able to solve. It's the only skyjacking in U.S. history that's unsolved, but it's turned into really a bit of a glamorous mystery, and that's probably part of the reason why the History Channel is going to open their premiere segment on this D.B. Cooper case.
I could totally see that. So what we were able to do, the Coast listeners, we were able to connect together a family with you that said, well, and like you'd heard a million other times before, I think my dad was D.B. Cooper or other people stepping forward, but this one really is proven, it's really borne out. Originally, the FBI was resistant to this testimony and this evidence, but that has changed because the FBI investigator has changed, correct?
Yes, and let me just talk just a minute, if I could, about this upcoming history segment. The former lead investigator for NORJAC is the FBI's code name for the D.B. Cooper case. He's been transferred, and about every 3 or 4 years, they assign a new agent to the case. Well, they got a new agent. I don't want to release the agent's name because he's also the head of the organized crime unit for the FBI up in the Northwest, and he told me he prefers to be a little lower profile, which I completely understand. But he is in charge of the D.B. Cooper case, and he and I have built up quite a friendship, and we communicate regularly, and we exchange information. And the FBI over the years has had over 1,100 D.B. Cooper suspects that they've had to eliminate. Now, here's the thing with the History Channel, and I have the utmost respect for those people that put the History Channel together. And also the National Geographic, which does a great TV show. Last year they came out with a D.B. Cooper special, but the thing is there was so much misinformation on that show, it literally caused the FBI to go back underground. They had played a minor role in this National Geo special, and it was so botched on the theory presented as the FBI's theory that the FBI no longer wanted to talk to the press or the public about it. And that's been over a year ago. Now, the History Channel, from what I understand, is going to focus on a different suspect when they air this show Thursday. And that suspect is a gentleman by the name of Kenny Christensen, who's been deceased for well over 15 years. And he was brought to light in an article out of New York City, I think it was the New York Magazine, back in 2007, and the reason they advanced the suspect, Kenny Christensen, is because his brother, Kenny Christensen's brother, Lyle, had a fantasy that his brother was D.B. Cooper, and the only evidence he had to prove was that his brother, Kenny, used to work as a flight attendant for Northwest Orient Airlines back in 1971, and he used to be a World War II paratrooper. So Lyle put this fantasy together and actually got some traction out of it. I was on a radio show back in 2007 with a guy named Mike Fitzsimmons out of Spokane, Washington. He asked me to come on the show, and I agreed, and they put Lyle on. And so I had a chance to talk directly to Lyle, and I asked Lyle directly on the phone, I said, do you have any hard evidence that your brother, Kenny Christensen, was the actual D.B. Cooper? And he hesitated. hesitated for about 5 seconds, and he said, no. And I said, well, why do you think he was D.B. Cooper? And he said, well, it's just a good story, and I like the story. And of course, that's not going to do it.
But it somehow it has gotten traction, because every time we take calls with you, somebody will call in and talk about Kenny Christensen, and that's what they're going to be focusing on in this upcoming episode.
Yeah,
and so
that's
so our guy is getting skipped over.
Well, and that's okay. Let them go ahead.
That's fine.
I have no problem. Like I said,
okay.
I think the History Channel does a good job.
That's great.
Here's the bottom line on Kenny Christensen. I met the FBI agent in Seattle a couple months ago, and face-to-face I asked him point blank if Kenny Christensen was still a suspect. And he told me, and these are his words, Kenny Christensen has been conclusively ruled out as a suspect. End of discussion.
Okay.
And I asked the FBI agent how they ruled him out. He wouldn't tell me, but I would imagine it was DNA. And also, Kenny Christensen doesn't carry the physical profile given by 4 good witnesses on the flight. So,
all right. Now, so we'll put that to bed for now. And to add, of course, we don't know for sure yet what they're going to say, but that's the way it's looking like. So in any way, you know, I'll still be watching it.
Sure.
I recommend other people do. But for people who really want to follow how this case could really play out in 2011, they should go to coasttocoastam.com and they should look at the photos, look at the evidence, look at the trail that we've been putting together step by step with every one of Galen Cook's appearances here on Coast to Coast as it just gets better and better. And now we have some new developments about the man that we are 100% sure is D.B. Cooper, and that comes in the form of some rediscovered letters.
Yep. Let me tell you about that. I'm going to break it into 2 parts, and I'm going to make it very quick and simple so the audience will get a bite on this. About a week ago, I was doing some research on the Internet, and I happened to come across a copy of an old letter that was sent to the Reno Evening Gazette newspaper, which is still the major daily in Reno, Nevada, but I think it's got a different name now. This was a letter that was received on the morning of November 29th, 1971, at the Reno Evening Gazette. And that night, they put this letter on the front page of their newspaper, and here's what the letter said. The envelope said, Reno Newspaper, Reno, Nevada. That was the address given, and it hit its target. The letter content said this, and it was clipped and pasted. There was no handwriting or signatures. It says, attention, thanks for hospitality, was in a rut, D.B. Cooper. Okay, now I'd seen that letter before, never paid much attention to it. It's almost a 40-year-old letter that got buried, but there was something curious about it because I wanted to know where the origin of this letter came. But before I discuss that, I want to discuss a little bit more about this letter. This wasn't the only letter sent to a major newspaper on the West Coast. There were 3 additional letters sent. And this is one of these buried facts about the D.B. Cooper case that we're going to have resurface. In fact, a gentleman by the name of John S. Craig, who's an investigative reporter, and he's going to put together a good story on the Internet under associated content. That's what he'll use as a vehicle. He's going to write a story next week about these newly discovered 4 letters. Now, the first letter went to Reno, Nevada. The second letter went to the Vancouver Province, which is the major daily up in Vancouver, British Columbia. And let me just tell you what the contents of that letter said. This one was handwritten out, and it appeared at the province, I believe it was on the 30th of November or the 1st of December, just 5 days after the D.B. Cooper hijacking. That letter said the composite drawing, which was circulating by the FBI at the early stages of the investigation, quote, unquote, does not represent the truth. In other words, the person that wrote this letter said, you don't have the composite correct. Here's what else the letter said. I enjoyed the Grey Cup game. Leaving Vancouver, thanks for the hospitality. Signed, D.B. Cooper.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, here's what's interesting about letter 1 and letter 2. They're both sent just days after the hijacking, and they're both sent to different cities in different countries, hundreds of miles apart,
yeah.
but they have identical content in each letter, and that is thanks for hospitality.
And identical unpublished content.
Yes. Well, the publication came, but after the letter had reached its target. Now, listen.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. So there is no way this could have been a copycat letter in Vancouver. Okay.
Yep. And when people read John S. Craig's article, which will be out here in less than a week on the Internet, it's going to really blow the lid into this case. Now, listen to this. There's two more letters. There was a letter that was sent to the Portland Oregonian. And here's basically what the content of that letter said. Am alive and doing well in hometown P.O., which you could construe to be Portland, Oregon. The system that beat the system, signed D.B. Cooper. And letter number four, which appeared again in the Reno Evening Gazette on Friday, December 3rd, 1971, said this. Plan ahead for retirement income, D.B. Cooper. And those are the four known letters ever sent by D.B. Cooper. Now, here's something interesting, Ian.
I like the fact that D.B. Cooper is giving people portfolio advice. That's
well,
all. Plan ahead for your retirement, signed D.B. Cooper.
Well, here's the interesting thing. In the early days, you could probably look at this and write it off as a bit of a hoax and say, How can you prove this was the real hijacker? But here's the thing. This letter that hit the Reno Evening Gazette on Monday, November 29th, 1971, was mailed from Oakdale, California, and it had the cancellation date of November 27th, which is on a Saturday, a couple of days ahead. And an enterprising reporter from the Modesto Bee examined this, and he noticed because the letter was published in the Reno paper, he said, hey, hold it. He said, I'm going to do some research in my paper. And he said four of those words that were put together, cut and pasted on the first letter, came out of the Modesto Bee newspaper on Friday, November 26th. So now you got a timeline. But here's part two of this whole thing. And this goes to the heart of my investigation. I can put my suspect, Bill Gossett, at each of these locations, not necessarily at that particular timeline, but he has been known to be in these locations. Letter number one was mailed from Oakdale, California, and about 25, 30 miles down the road from Oakdale, which is a little dinky town, is a larger town called Merced, California.
Right.
Bill Gossett lived in Merced, California for 10 years. He got married in Merced. He raised three kids in Merced. And he also served on the police department in Merced. Okay. Letter number two, which hits Vancouver, British Columbia. This was Bill Gossett's stomping ground. In fact,
I'm going to give you the two-minute warning here, too.
I can get her done in 2 minutes. Bill Gossett's kids tell me that this is where Bill Gossett stashed D.B. Cooper money, was up in Vancouver. Letter number three, which hits Portland, Oregon. This is Bill Gossett's location for the last 13 years of his life. He lived in Oregon. So I can place Bill Gossett in all of these locations. Now, back to Reno, why would D.B. Cooper want to send a letter to Reno, Nevada? Because that's where the plane landed after it was hijacked. It was in Reno, and obviously, if you put a timeline together and start examining where these letters originate, and John S. Craig is going to describe this in a much longer detailed article, but you can start to see that there's a possibility that D.B. Cooper is hinting around at his activities after the skyjacking, and he's kind of taunting the FBI. And he's letting the media know that he's alive and well, and he can move around from city to city and country to country.
He was loving every minute of it.
Ian, I think you and I are loving every minute of it too.
Yeah, but this I think he was. Story. I think he was loving every minute of it. He was. And what we know from his kids about their father and about his life, this is a guy who didn't waste many days. He had a lot going on. He had a lot that he did. The whole, you know, that kind of weird priesthood thing he got into, all this other stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a man in full. But
you're going to hear a lot more about these letters in the coming weeks, Ian.
I promise you. Well, this is what I look forward to too. I'm really hoping that this will be the year 2011. This is when we'll get the FBI to say we have solved the case of D.B. Cooper. Thank you, Galen Cook, and thank you, Coast to Coast audience. We'll park it there for now. And now that we've handled the past and the present, let's look ahead into the future. The things which are coming, which you need to know about, will directly affect you coming up next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. You know, the best way to look about the future from my perspective is not that we're on a timeline, an arrow projection going straight forward, because we don't really. But we are in this kind of cyclonic model, I think, in the future, where we follow the same cycles, but somehow the trajectory just gets larger. The sort of meta-narrative just gets longer. But we do follow, we do go in kind of these concentric, these ever-growing concentric circles in time, as time spirals forward. So some things will look familiar. Sometimes we'll be in a place where it looks like we're just repeating history. But then we get into another place and realize, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much more out here, which we have yet to discover. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to talk about the study of the future, as well as what studying the future will tell us about where we'll be in it in just the next couple of years, coming up next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Andy Hines is an executive in residence and a lecturer at the University of Houston's Futures Studies Program, a program which was founded, right, by Dr. Peter Bishop, amongst others. But you were the founder of the program, weren't you, Dr. Bishop?
I wish I had been, Ian. No, I am actually second generation.
Okay.
Two other professors founded it in the 1970s.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for that. But you are currently, I think you are looked upon by all futurists here as sort of the godfather for all of the ones that are coming, don't you think?
I don't know about the metaphor there, but yeah, it's my program now, no doubt about it.
Yeah. And also as co-founder of the Association of Professional Futurists, which I've been proudly associating myself with over the last year or so and learn from every day and continue to want to grow in. Andy Hines and Peter Bishop are formative in this field of future studies. Now, currently, before Andy, I bring you in, let me go back to you, Peter, for just a second. How many universities currently offer a futures studies program right now?
Well, there are two freestanding degrees in the United States, and there is also a concentration in a political science degree at the University of Hawaii that actually predated our program, also in the, you know, founded in the early 70s. Worldwide, there's about a dozen to 20. It depends on, you know, what grade, where you draw the line, but there's about, you know, 10 to 12 programs around the world right now, which is tiny compared to what we compare ourselves with the other side of the timeline, which is history. Every single university, college, grade school has a history, you know, component, and we've got a long way to go to match that.
Yeah, and yet we're all dealing with the future. The future is in front of us, all of the living, and oftentimes history is the joke the living play upon the dead. So, you know, there's lots to do to reform history and to think about history, and I love history, but we all will be directly impacted by the future. And so thank you so much, Dr. Bishop and Andy Hines, for coming on. Andy, I always enjoy your work, and I enjoy reading the various blogs and the contributions that come up through the APF sort of network. So, Andy, let me just ask you up front, what are you up to these days, and what exciting things have you been watching as you look ahead in 2011 and beyond?
Well, Ian, it's, first of all, it's great to have you as part of the Association of Professional Futurists. I think a lot of the exciting work I've been paying a lot of attention to is around some shifts in consumer or slash citizen values and actually finally put together a book concept around it that I hope is going to come out this spring. It's going to be something like Consumer Shift.
Okay.
And,
very interesting.
We're looking at how some long-term trends in value changes may be getting a boost from the Great Recession and kind of speeding up a transition away from some of the values that have characterized the last couple of decades.
Well, and I think that's so interesting. I can't wait to find out more about that here in the next few minutes. But then that broadens the question then to either Peter or Andy. Is how do we define the future? How do we talk about it? How do we put that into, other than just what's going to happen tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, how do we really sort of confine the conversation to talk about what the future is bringing us?
Well, the first thing, we have to identify is that the future doesn't exist. So, and that's one of the reasons why perhaps there are so few programs that study the future, because it's much more a concept of our ideas and our images and our hopes, our fears, with various things. We know that the present, which is a kind of a moving thing, will move down the line, and there will be a future. But what we're talking about really is what we think about and how we prepare for change coming down the line in terms of time. Andy, is that the way you think of it?
Yeah, I think, we have the theoretical construct is the 200-year present. So, if you're, what happened 100 years before, what's happening 100 years after. Certainly, though, in our corporate or consulting experience, the time frames are something like 2, 5, and 10 years.
Explain a 2, 5, 10-year time frame. What do you mean by that?
So, typically when working with clients, a 10-year project is a bit of a stretch. You know, most organizations feel that's unfathomable. We think about what's going to happen 10 years from now. 5 years is certainly a little bit more tangible, and then 2 years is the comfort zone. So a lot of what we do is how do we stretch people beyond the 2, 5, and sometimes even get them beyond the 10.
And in this way too, then what? If I'm drawing together what you're saying, is it's hard to commodify the future. It's hard to talk about the future as an entity, although it is something that we will all be facing. But we can't stand around it. We can't put a microscope on it. We can't check its heartbeat. We can't do any of these things. We don't have any literature from the future yet. We can't get in a time capsule, go there, and come back and say, hey, this is what's coming. And I'm not comparing it in the same way to theology in that, Peter, you said you're studying something that doesn't exist, but I would say in the same way that you're studying something which is intangible, it is a little bit more like theology than it is like history.
Well, but first you first have to identify the fact that the past doesn't exist either.
All right, fair enough.
In that sense, the future and the past are the same thing. The difference is that in the past, we have that stuff left over.
Right.
So we've got books and pictures and documents and bones and buildings, and from that we can infer what that past was like, even though it doesn't exist anymore. Our problem with the future is that, as you pointed out, nobody's left stuff for us yet. So it's a different – neither one exists, but the thought process is different from one to the other.
But in the way that we have to be careful, I would say the comparison to theology to me is that it's really easy to read into – there's a common expression that the God that's described by most theologians is really just them with a deeper voice. And so it's important as a future to study the future that you aren't trying to make the future in your own image and likeness.
Well, we distinguish between various kinds of futures, and we at the University of Houston distinguish three basic kinds of futures. There's the expected future, which is kind of where we're headed and what will happen if nothing surprising happens, if all our assumptions turn out to be true. Now, nobody expects that future exactly to happen, but it is a type of future. And then there are all the other futures, the result of surprises and events and things like that. But the third kind is a preferable future. It is trying to bend the trajectory, so to speak, of the future towards a future which is more preferable for ourselves, for our families, our community, the nation, and indeed the planet as a whole. So in some sense, we are trying to mold the future not necessarily as an image of ourselves, but why study it and why act, why make decisions, why take risks unless we're working for some goal, and that goal is to make a more preferable future.
Andy, where are you on that?
Well, yeah, the whole point of studying the future is to map what do we think it's going to look like, what are the possibilities, and then given the possibilities, what do we do about it now? So the whole point of the future is to change the present decision. So if this is where we want to go, how do we get there?
All right, well, let's go back to what you were talking about before, Andy, about how you see the recent economic downturns are creating an environment where we are reconsidering values, and you're seeing that on the horizon here in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and one of the fun challenges of that is, as futurists, we've thought for a long time, the last couple of decades, we've been talking about we get to a future where there's, limits on resources, less economic growth, more constraints in a world of limits, right? And that's been talked about for a long time. And what we've been doing in the last couple of years is trying to paint some tangible pictures of what does that world look like, and getting it away from that it's some sort of catastrophic, that there's actually a way that we can, live in that kind of a world where it's something that organizations and people can plan for, prepare for, and actually, shape that kind of an outcome in a more favorable way.
Well, and I like that, but I'm also mindful of the habit that a lot of people have to, say, be bleak about the future for the planet because they're bleak about the future for themselves. And so suddenly the lens they see the future through gets very small. And they can't see outside of what they think their own likelihood of success will be. So if they're not going to be happy, well, things are going to hell in a handbasket. And that's the only way they're going to think about the future.
It's kind of funny, though. One of the things we know is that individuals are much more optimistic about their future than everybody else's. So we kind of think we'll be okay. It's those rest of the people that we have to worry about.
Good. Now, what have you been seeing recently then in terms of values that you think will be informing our future that could be helpful to think about in 2011?
Yeah, I think, one of the big shifts is certainly away from an emphasis on material goods consumption. And, part of that shift is, so instead of buying things, we want experiences. And I think another way that's manifesting, and we got this from one of our APF colleagues down in Australia. We called it enoughness.
Enoughness.
It's this sense that I have enough stuff, and I want to get back control of my life and my time, not just my financial, but my sort of control of my time. And I've had so in a sense I want to stop. Reassess where I'm going, what I'm doing, what my priorities are. And, the recession has certainly given some, real life urgency to that question. So that's kind of where we're seeing people now, and that kind of rethinking, what am I doing with my life, and where do I want to go from here?
There was a study, and I don't know the exact nature of it, but they asked college students if you could have a choice of two different kinds of lives. Earn $50,000 a year and get 8 hours sleep a night versus earn $100,000 and get 4 hours sleep a night. And most of them chose the 50, a life that was somewhat more contented and less economically prosperous.
Well, and that's very interesting. Again, we're talking with Dr. Peter Bishop and Andy Hines, both of the University of Houston's Future Studies Program. If you're trying to separate the two out, Dr. Bishop sounds vaguely like Dennis Weaver whenever he talks. So,
you know how to flatter a guy, Ian.
Well, I just for people trying to check who's saying what. But sorry. So then again, though, how does that inform economically? Say somebody has a small to medium sized business, or they have 10 to 15 employees. How can information like that you're gathering about how people are thinking about their individual future, and then also the collective future for the society they want to be in, how is this enoughness concept how will that be helpful for people in anticipating change in the future?
This is Andy. One thing that's for the small business, it's actually, you know, the globalization and communications technology are making it possible for small businesses, somebody working out of their home office to be serving customers literally around the globe. But I think that for the small business, that actually it's a fairly natural transition. The ones that are having trouble are the big multinationals who, you know, the whole premise of most big multinationals is next year is going to be bigger than the previous year, which was bigger than the previous, you know, the whole assumption is based on continued growth. And for them, those have been a lot of our clients in the futures business, and we've been, you know, trying to get them to think about what does an economy look like that isn't automatically getting bigger every year, and how do you change your business model to serve that? And it can be done, but it's different, right? It's a different paradigm, if you will.
And this is Peter. I think based on what Andy said, if I were a business person and I were in a material business, I was selling stuff. On the other hand, I would also emphasize the experience of buying that stuff and having people in relationship with me, and that giving them a good experience, and this is not new, this is brand loyalty, and this is customer satisfaction and customer service, but I would emphasize that at least as much, if not more so, than just the stuff I'm trying to sell them and getting money from them.
Does this speak to the success of the Apple products?
Well, they're certainly fiercely loyal customers. And, yeah, it is. In fact, it's the cachet of being part of that brand and part of the community of people that associate with that brand. So, yeah, absolutely.
And that's really the business model for Starbucks. I mean, coffee is coffee, and their brand of coffee is probably better than what you get out of the grocery store. But they also are, their real brand is about the experience of a coffee shop and relationships and friendships, what people have come to call the third place. It's not home. It's not work. It's a third place where I can go and be with people in a different kind of a way. And if they didn't have that experience, you wouldn't charge a couple of bucks for a latte.
You know, I think we see that third place idea. This is how mainstream that concept has become of a third place, not home, not work, but even McDonald's commercials have been framing that idea as being a third place, not a fast food place that you go in, get your food, eat it, get out, and crumple a paper and walk, but rather you could bring your laptop, bring your Wi-Fi, have great coffee, sit down, and they would love to have you think of that as your third place.
So what Andy's talking about is that it's the experience as much as the food, if not more so.
Right. Well, it may be especially true in the case of McDonald's.
Right. But part of that, too, is it's part of the value shift towards, you know, there's a renewed emphasis on connection. I want to be connected to my neighbors. I want to be more connected to the products and services I buy. I want to be more connected to the organizations that I associate with. And, you know, that third place is even, I don't want to sit in a home office by myself. I want to be out. I want to connect with other people while I'm doing my work.
You know, I hear that a lot from a little bit from the radio thing, is that people talk to me more about that they feel many more people working at home, and they don't have a TV on, but they like hearing other human voices while they're working. It gives them the feeling of connectivity of an office, and they don't feel so isolated when they're in a home office.
Right, and that's the new the emerging norm of work, is that people are working at, you know, outside the traditional the office space, and so as you know, as that concept mainstreams, there's really lots of competition for where's the third, you know, where is that third space going to be that people are going to congregate in.
And right.
I've done a lot of work with libraries in the last couple of years, and you know, one of the ideas we've talked about with them is, like, you have great space, you have great buildings. If you would let people talk and drink coffee, they would probably want to congregate in your place, right?
I think that's a really, really good point.
Yeah.
And there have been more and more coffee shops opening up in libraries.
Right.
But you're right. When you're there, it's hush-hush still, and an expectation – that everybody's going to treat that like church or something while they're inside. But that's not the way the trend is going. Well, that's why we've got future watchers on for the rest of this evening on Coast to Coast, Dr. Peter Bishop and Andy Hines from the University of Houston. I'm going to ask them to address that statement that I made earlier and have used a couple of times to promo the show tonight, which is that the big jobs of 2015 haven't been invented yet. We'll talk about that coming up next. And then also some of the other big trends that are coming that maybe you're already experiencing. But either way, you're going to want to know about coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. And we'll be talking about the future, which we hope you're going to feel like you're going to want to welcome it into your home. It's coming anyway. Even if it doesn't exist, the future is coming. And what are the ways we can shape the future, both for us personally and then for society? One of the ways you start is what we were getting at there a few minutes ago, knowing what our values are and how they're shifting, and then also figuring out where do we stand in relationship to those values. Are we born in the right time, in a way? Are we finding ourselves open to the possibilities of what's coming? This is just part of what comes when we study the future. We'll get back to that with two people who teach it at the University of Houston coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Peter Bishop with the University of Houston and Andy Hines as well. Andy is also a very active consultant in the business world, and he's going to link up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll talk with some more people who work as futurists coming up next hour as well, and then Peter and Andy will be back to take your calls in the last hour on Coast to Coast. So we were talking about the future from a couple of different angles. Let me ask you about that statement that the biggest jobs of 2015 haven't been invented yet. Where are you with that?
Well, if I could start on that, this is Andy. I'm not sure if they'll be the biggest jobs, but I certainly think there'll be some new ones. I was looking at one of the lists that we put together a couple of years ago. My colleague Mark Justman had one called the virtual real estate developer. So that is developing virtual tourism businesses, virtual adventure packages, and virtual retail destinations.
And it's not happening yet, but it will be in the sense, right? I mean, that type of how one would be able to turn that into an occupation isn't something you could start doing tomorrow, but we think by what year?
Yeah, well, the next 5 to 10 years, absolutely.
Yeah.
We see like the leading edge of that kind of change happening already, and you know, another 5 to 10 years, that kind of thing will emerge as a legitimate job title. Maybe something like your online reputation manager.
Online reputation manager. I need one of those. I don't know what it is, but I know I need one.
Right. We have such a presence. You know, we're on Facebook, we're in LinkedIn, we're in Twitter, and we're on all these social media sites, and a lot's being said about us, lots being written about us, and we may need the services of a professional to make sure that what's being said and talked about us in that online space is the way we want it to be.
You know, there is a service already that exists that will send you alerts when your name comes up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
But they don't manage it, per se. They just tell you about it. And so this would be somebody who more in the realm of what we might think of traditionally as a publicist or an agent might see it's in their financial future. It's in their best interests to manage your reputation, just like a publicist or an agent would, even though they're not perhaps promoting you per se. The better you look online, the more money they might make, or the more their bonus structure might be, or they get a part of your salary, maybe even if you'd structure them as part of your salary team.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Peter, what about you? What do you think of that idea? I think it's actually Joel Barker who was the first one to say that on the show last year, that the biggest jobs of 2015 haven't been invented yet. Where are you with that?
Well, there will be. I think I agree with Andy that there will be some jobs that will come along in 15. I don't think they're necessarily the biggest jobs. When Andy said virtual real estate developer, I thought that the real estate is actually cyber real estate. and there may be people who will actually sell space, like GoDaddy, or some of the domain people will actually think of themselves as selling space in the cyber world. And then the in terms of the reputation manager, some folks are talking about actually selling your information, that your information is valuable to companies and you will get micropayments when they do that. Loyalty credits like airline frequent flyer miles and credits you get at the grocery store and other things are a version of that. But that may actually be a big business where people will be interested in managing and actually making income on the information that they allow people to have about you.
Well, that's very interesting. So you could find a way. I mean, if we all become a commodity in that what the products we buy or the products we don't buy or however we manage our life, that information has a specific cash value. It may not be much. It may not be worth a ton. We're not perhaps individually any of us are game changers or we don't influence a product that much that we can make or break a product. However, if you put enough of those people together, then almost like penny stocks or something, you could have something that would be really worth investing in if you were a company and you were trying to track how products were being accepted or services were being used, like that?
In a completely different domain, I always look for medical and biological growth throughout the next couple of decades, really. There was just an executive order that allows Medicare to pay for end-of-life counseling. Previously was not allowed, was not reimbursable. There may be end-of-life counselors, people choosing about treatment, about when to, you know, what kind of treatment to have, preserving quality of life, hospice and things like that. So there's another occupation that I could see emerging before 2015.
It doesn't really exist right now, but we could see the seeds for it. That's especially for people who are thinking about traditional occupations like being a doctor or being a lawyer as being some sort of guaranteed ticket to financial success. And that's part of what we learn when we study the future, is that sometimes we have to get rid of our prejudices from the past. And that is one of those things where you talk to a lot of doctors who really are having a hard time even paying back their med school loans, that may never be able to pay back their med school loans, or for that matter, lawyers who can't find work, period.
Well, there's a lot of work in the law. We had a lawyer take our certificate program last May. He was a personal injury lawyer, and his major issue was automobile safety. We know we just hit a record low in terms of automobile fatalities with new kinds of devices, and those are coming on very much faster than before. And he wondered whether he would have a business in terms of representing clients with respect to automobile companies and insurance companies if automobile fatalities went down to a very low level. So even though the law will still be there, various specialties could easily go away.
Well, fair point. I mean, even in a corporate sense or other places, there aren't the guarantees now of what, you know, if you were 18 years old or 19 years old like my son, thinking, what do I want to do 5 years from now, 6 years from now? Some very rewarding careers are coming online that don't really exist yet, that if somebody were to start planning for it, they might find they will be one of a few going into a field that's growing as opposed to one of a many in a field that is shrinking, or at least where the money pool may be shrinking. Andy, I want to ask about other trends you see coming in 2011. You work with corporations. You've worked with some large corporations like Dow Chemical. What do these big corporations, how do they look at futurism and ideation? How do they look at those as a way of protecting themselves?
Well, a lot of what I've done and my colleagues, what we do for organizations is where are those big mega trends coming, and you know what do they mean in terms of like where are the new businesses of the future going to come from, and to tie that like to the job titles, like one of the titles I thought of that fits is the carbon footprint eraser. So you know all have a carbon, right? We all make a carbon footprint, including you know individuals and organizations,
right?
And you know a whole host of businesses and services around managing that. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, large organizations are looking at, you know, these environmental trends that are coming along and saying, you know, how is that going to change our business? And where are the new opportunities for us?
you know, building a business around reducing impacts is, you know, is one of the creative ways that, you know, organizations can, you know, approach what might seem to be a threatening development to them.
Yeah, that's very interesting. A lot of what we talk about when we talk about things like carbon footprints and carbon exchange and all of these, it still seems way off into the future, although I know it's not. And I wonder whether you can talk, either of you can talk more about how the environment in the next 5 years is going to be affecting our economy. Andy, we'll start with you.
Well, I would certainly say that, you know, in my 20 years doing this work, the environment has been something that we've been talking about forever. And what's clearly happened in the last 5-10 years is it's gone from one of those fringe concerns to it's really a front and center issue with almost any organization we work with. You know, certainly some, you know, some are more affected than others, but everybody's thinking about it and they're taking it serious. I remember I gave a talk to one of the library groups, and they were talking about their green library strategy. And I was like, well, geez, I didn't know you guys were polluters in the first place. But
right.
You know, it's just that idea is so widespread that it's you know, everybody's taking it serious.
Peter?
One of the developments we'll see right away this year is the appearance of fully electric vehicles, electric plug-ins. And we expect within 20 or 30 years that a substantial proportion, if not a majority, of the personal vehicle fleet will be driven by electricity rather than by liquid fuel. So that's happening already.
Yeah, I think that is a trend. I'm sort of curious to see this commercial they were saying I saw on TV about all the different places you're going to see the plug-ins start coming. So it was a way of sort of reassuring you, even before perhaps you've ever even opened a brochure for an electric vehicle, that if you're going to go down to the beach, you're going to go to the forest, you're going to go to the coffee shop, you're going to go on a 100-mile, you know, adventure trip, that there will be a plug-in waiting for you when you get there. And I thought that was an interesting psychological shift, trying to get the consumer to sort of head off that problem, that marketing problem at the pass, by trying to create that image that these plugs, look for them, you're going to start seeing them everywhere, because now I'm looking for them, and I still don't see them, but I get the feeling that they really are coming.
Sure. That's why, Ian, the values are so important. I mean, understanding where people are coming from, because technically we can do so many things technologically that, you know, often are way ahead of what the marketplace will accept. And, you know, like you say, you have to prep the marketplace. And right now, like hybrid vehicles, in a sense, are, you know, kind of the first baby step on the road to what, you know, as Peter's mentioned, with the plug-in. And, you know, it's hard to just jolt people from, you know, from A to B without some sort of process to kind of prepare prepare the way. Because people would, you know, don't like to change suddenly. They prefer the change to be slow or gradual, if at all.
Right. Well, see, but that's interesting, because that goes back to something we kind of started with, of how do people approach change? And that you said at the beginning, most people tend to be much more optimistic about the future for themselves. And yet I think there is a little bit of a paradox. Is they wish things didn't have to change, but if they are, they feel pretty good about their future. Yes?
Absolutely. I think certainly our experience is that, you know, certain working with organizations and individuals, that the general preference is to keep things as they are or to keep things on the present trend. And like Peter says, we look at the expected future. And one of the things that we've learned in our business is that we call the expected future the least likely future, because always something else comes along.
Peter?
There's a big difference between the where people get their knowledge about the future, and there's two huge levels, of course. There's our own personal experience, and then there is what we know about society in general. Our own personal experience, as Andy's pointed out, is fairly good. I mean, the research on happiness says that people have a kind of a set point, and some people are naturally more happy than others, but most people, even people without tremendous means or even in sickness or whatever, tend to be fairly solid in terms of their level of happiness, 7 to 8 on a 10-point scale. On the other hand, their knowledge of society in general tends to be fairly bleak. And I now go back to your business, Ian, in terms of the media. The media, of course, is a business that wants to get people's attention. And what gets a bit attention is not optimism and happiness, but, you know, something more about threat and challenge and drama and problems and things like that. So we have, for instance, surveys that say, take education, for instance. Everybody says, oh, education's terrible, it's awful, it's broken. And you ask them about their own schools or their kids' schools, and they say, no, you know, they're doing pretty well. The same thing is true about Congress. Congress is a terrible organization. Nobody respects Congress. Oh, except our guy is doing a good job for us.
Now,
so we have a huge disconnect between what we experience personally in our own personal lives and this macro world, mostly what we get from the media, broadcast, newspapers, the internet, places like that.
You know, I always thought. And that you're probably right that it probably still is true by and large, but I also have begun to wonder whether that's even changed. The idea that, no, well, our congressman's okay, but the rest of them, they're all bums, throw them out. I feel like, and maybe I'm just hearing the rhetoric wrong, and I do think the media takes a big role in this. During the last election cycle, maybe the last two or three election cycles, it is much more a sense, I think, of nobody is good enough. And whether it's enough, you know, all of the – there's nobody can live up to the scrutiny that they're given for who they are. Not one person. And after they're in office, the first job, it would seem, of the opposition party on either side is to attempt to dismantle their reputation and therefore, I think, continue to sort of discredit whether anybody could ever be good enough to do these jobs. And I wonder whether we're coming to a kind of tipping point on that, too, in the future.
Well, clearly, you know, the negativism and the partisanship and all of that is there. But take a look at this last election, which was, in a sense, was described as a huge shift. And I think it was something like 65 seats or something. 65 seats in the House of Representatives is still only about 15%. That meant that 85% of the people kept their seats. Everybody was up for reelection. Everybody except 65 did okay, rough terms. So there still is a huge sense that my own personal life is doing okay. It's the rest of the world, as Andy says, is really where the problems are.
That's a fair point. All right. And so while I've got you both here, let's talk a little bit about who we've got coming up next hour, too. And if you would set the table for Gary Golden and Terry Grimm. Andy, want to do that a little bit?
Sure. Well, how about I'll take Terry, and then I'll let Peter do Gary. So Terry Grimm spent a great deal of time with IBM, and part of that work was in strategy. And really in the inner workings of how strategy works in a large organization, we were colleagues in a consulting company together that was devoted exclusively to helping organizations think about the future and plan for the future and act on the future. And so she's done a lot of work in this strategy and, you know, making, you know, helping organizations change how they approach the future.
And then, Peter, you want to explain the work of Gary Golden quickly?
Yeah, sure. Gary is also a graduate of our program as an independent futurist working out of Brooklyn, New York right now. And his expertise is primarily in the future of technology, primarily energy technology and transportation and the other things that are related to that. He and I did a major project together on the future of transportation for the state of Texas a few years ago. He's also got another interesting domain, and that is the millennial generation and the differences between the basically 20-somethings and the baby boom and how that is going to shift. So I hope you'll ask him about that when he comes on the next week.
We will. We'll get to them both coming up next hour then on Coast to Coast. Gary Golden talking about millennials and the future. Terry Grimm talking about some business changes that are coming up, their research, their forecasts for 2011 and beyond. And then we'll get Andy and Peter back to take your calls coming up in the last hour. And Peter, we're going to do something about that phone one way or another. We got to, because I want so much to hear what you have to say for the questions in the last hour. People have a chance to talk about becoming a futurist, as well as then their own questions about these deep trends these long trends that we're starting to see develop right now. I hope you were taking notes about some of those job suggestions. I've got a thought on the suggestion about somebody who would be an online image manager, somebody that would be there as a reputation protector, somebody who would handle your who you are and what you would be, you know, what all the different ways in which you'd be mentioned online. I'll tell you, based on another experience, what I think how that could really turn into a great job for somebody in the future. But there's a big caveat there on the person that's going to hang their shingle out. And I'll get to that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So it's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about the future studies, both as a way that other people out there are creating a new market opportunity for them in and around whatever jobs they're in. So every industry would be requiring more and more work of futurists in the future. How to prepare to become a futurist. We were talking about the University of Houston's program last hour, but also last hour we were talking about some of the ways in which futurists work and are showing jobs that are on the horizon, jobs that may that don't actually exist. No one's getting paid for them at this exact moment, but somebody could be making a great living off it within 5 years. It seems kind of hard to imagine, perhaps, that a terrific job could come up that fast that doesn't exist right now. But we also touched on the idea of corporations having to do a better job of seeing how these future trends are going to affect their bottom line. And we'll talk more about that with a couple people who study those very specifically. Gary Golden is coming up next, and then Terry Grimm on the way. Gary Golden, as we just heard about, specializes in the millennials, this generation of consumers on the way. What trends do we see coming from that group next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. Gary Golden is a professional futurist who works with major corporations like IBM, also the with government organizations like the U.S. Army Logistics Innovation Agency and the Texas Department of Transportation, just to name a couple. And a pleasure to talk with you, Gary. How are you tonight?
Doing well, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Oh, please. You're a very interesting guy, and I love the kind of work you're doing, especially as we were just hearing about the work about millennials. But let's back up a little bit and just ask you, in broad brushes, what do you see coming up in 2011? Either payoffs from past trends as a futurist that you've been watching that you're seeing coming to fruition, or some of the early signs of some other trends which you've been keeping an eye on?
Sure. So, well, in the space of kind of generational shifts, I think the thing we're likely to see in the next year and, you know, suddenly beyond is the increase in the number of millennials inside the workplace. And there's a pretty wide spectrum of implications to consider. But the one that people are really focused on is millennials being more social and more transparent in the workplace. So how do we leverage more productivity with this workforce that desires to be more social and transparent in everything that they do.
Define the demographic of millennials for people that don't know exactly what age group you're talking about.
Sure. So the U.S. is divided largely into three cohorts. The baby boomers were born 1946, 1964. There's Generation X, 1964, let's say 1978. And then the millennials are 1978, 80 through 2000. So these are the sons and daughters of the baby boomer generation.
And some of the characteristics of millennials, what shapes a millennial that's different than, say, a Gen Xer?
Yeah, so millennials, you know, they grew up in a period of relative economic prosperity, and they had very positive relationships with their parents. So they tend to be more civically oriented. They tend to be more optimistic and positive in how they see their future and the future of the world. So little less skepticism, as most people will measure, compared to other generations, and much more technology oriented.
Well, and I think that's that technology oriented thing too, where it's, you know, it's like babies with iPads, for God's sakes. I mean, they're just, but it's somehow there's a natural there's a sort of a natural cohesion of technology and millennials, unlike any other generation that's ever come before it.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, what Andy has hinted at before, it's understanding not just the behavior of the technology, but the value shifts that it represents, that's important for us to get our head around.
All right. So that means going back again to hiring millennials, millennials becoming an increasingly larger part of the workforce. And that means managing or understanding how you're supposed to manage their need to be connected socially, usually through technology, at almost every minute.
Absolutely. And then they also take a very different approach to the boundaries between work and life. So whereas, you know, some of us may struggle with this new demand to, you know, work this 24/7 lifestyle, millennials are a little bit more adaptive to having more, you know, life at work and work at home.
Well, that's interesting because I work with a lot of millennials, and I would say they pace themselves very differently.
That would be very kind of you.
Yeah, and I've tried to be, but they pace themselves very differently than I would. And I don't always know quite how to handle it, other than I notice that if you try not to micromanage something, if you can lay off a little bit, give it a little bit of time, it eventually the things get done. But they may not get done in a way, in a linear fashion that I would have felt like I needed to do it in order to prove something to my boss.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in kind of that study the workforce and millennials will say that they approach productivity in this collaborative sense. So whereas they might you know, be very goal oriented in their own lives, they really do look to their colleagues, to the team, to really finish things off. So some of that different approach to their pacing could be the result of a more collaborative approach to getting things done. So they do a little bit and then they expect others to help finish it off.
And they're less competitive, it would seem. And not in the same way that it's like you would see, the kind of thing we think. I was just watching some black and white movie from the 50s about, you know, post World War II, that's kind of a Mad Men almost motif to it, but it was actually a movie from the 50s, and everybody was out to try to make $12 more than the guy at the desk next to him. And it was all about getting closer to getting that house and the baby and the whole bit. And it's like, wow, that does seem like it. That was even removed from my own experience. To my kids, that seems like another planet.
Yeah, so millennials were raised to be great team players, right? So they grew up in an environment where they were encouraged to participate, to play their role, and they were rewarded as such. So the big saying with millennials is that everyone gets a trophy. Everyone gets a trophy. So they really grew up in this team collaborative culture, which is certainly going to have an impact on the workplace.
All right. So then what do you see then coming up in 2011? What jobs, what's on the way in our future as a society that we should be prepared for? And what are the things that we can be prepared for business-wise to be able to take advantage of?
Sure. So maybe build a bridge to the other areas of my focus in terms of transportation and energy. We're going to see real growth in terms of jobs in the energy sector around this notion of the smart grid, so a smarter infrastructure which combines software and sensors to create a much more dynamic energy grid that's going to demand new types of skills in the workplace. So that's one area. And then the other around vehicle electrification, as much as we pay attention to cars and their kind of environmental footprint, it's really the role of software that's changing transportation in the future. Using software to reduce vehicle collisions, to improve driver attentiveness. So we think of the automobile workforce of 2015, it's likely to include programmers, software developers, not just people that are assembling cars on the factory floor.
Okay, so I want to amplify something that you said because it came up last hour when we were talking about the future of the next couple of years and this idea about electric cars. This is not a fad. You're not proposing. This is kind of like where we had that almost sort of a false start from electric cars a couple of years ago, which gave people the impression, I don't know if I would get one. I don't know if this is really the future. If I'm hearing everybody correct tonight, this is here to stay.
Absolutely. So I always say that the automobile industry is not trying to change its environmental footprint. It's trying to change its manufacturing footprint. So the combustion engine is a very complicated mechanical system that requires a very intensive supply chain and a lot of labor. And when you shift to an electric vehicle platform, you can use more modular parts. So building electric cars in the long run is going to be much more cheaper to build for the automobile company. So it is not a question of if, it is a question of when and how fast will it happen.
And they want that. That's good news for them. That's just good news to have. So that's one of the reasons why we think this is going to stick around.
Absolutely. And what it does is it opens up opportunities for shifting the value chain away from new cars, right, where we only make money if we're GM and Ford by selling a new car, to selling services every time we get in that vehicle, or some sort of mobility service when we're taking the bus or a train or a subway. So it really is a shift in the value chain of the automobile sector from new cars to mobility services.
You know, and I've been sort of fascinated with this trend that I see so much of, the idea of trying to find ways to recover a residual income from the sale of something, almost like on a subscription basis, like when I bought a vehicle a couple of years ago and they said, you know, and it comes complete with satellite radio. Well, that means an investment every month, and I'm sure that the seller of this item also gets a small taste of this or some sort of kickback for this, that every month, even though I bought the vehicle many years ago and I'm not paying on the vehicle anymore, but I still pay every month for the privilege of having a connected satellite radio in the dashboard. And I think there's got to be more and more companies who are looking for ways to become like a new kind of utility, that they get paid every month for the service that they're going to offer you.
Absolutely. So that in the industry is called the aftermarket. So if the 20th century was a battle between GM and Ford, the 21st century might be a battle between GM OnStar and Ford Sync, which are their telematic services. So there was a speech a few years ago that a GM executive said that they would need, let's say, $250 a month per month from somebody and they could give away the car for free. So as long as they have that service model, not just a product model, but a service model around electric vehicles, I think the auto industry has a very bright future and will create new jobs that do not exist today.
Well, that's really interesting, because let's go back a few years ago to when buying a cell phone was expensive up front and then expensive on a monthly basis. Then the technology became, you know, like coconuts and string. And so you would get the phone for free, and a very nice phone and a phone with all the bangs and whistles on it for free, as long as you signed up for the monthly subscription rate.
Absolutely. And then the other thing with transportation that I think you're likely to see, let's say after 2015, is this emergence of a new business model around on-demand transportation. So not just a zip car where you rent by the hour, but really a point-to-point solution. So I go from my house to the train station, or I go from the parking lot to the sports stadium. I take a vehicle for 1 mile or 2 mile that I do not own. I simply pay for access. And this is innovation around the whole urban transportation market, which is widely considered to be the growth market for transportation in the future.
We're talking with Gary Golden, professional futurist, and so you are amplifying that from what we heard last hour too, from Peter and from Andy, that these changes here that we see, that actually you can invest in them. If you're somebody who's listening right now thinking, well, you know, I could lay back and I could wait, these things are already happening. They're going down, and you should be prepared for them. I want to go back to something, though, that Andy said about when I asked him about which jobs that may not exist right now, that may be some of the big paying jobs of 2015. And he mentioned something about this idea of being an online reputation manager. Do you have a thought on that?
Certainly. So I think that he laid out the landscape well enough. I think that you probably are going to see it emerge around the specific context. So more and more companies are allowing their workers to be more public. So they're allowing them to blog and to tweet and things of that nature. So if you were someone looking to become an online identity manager, your client is probably not the individual as much as it is a company who has a large group of individuals that it's looking to kind of protect and shield.
Well, I like that, because I would begin to think about that in terms of agents as I work with them. And there's that caveat out there that if you're looking to have somebody who's going to become your agent, you want actually a small agency. You want somebody who'll be able to pick up the phone when you call. You don't want an agent that has a million famous people, because you'll never talk to that agent ever in your life anyway. So you might as well go with somebody smaller. And you also need somebody whose reputation themselves is going to be something that will be worthy of you investing in. So if you have somebody who's going to be protecting reputations, how will they distinguish themselves from some fly-by-night group that's going to get access to all of your personal online data, all of your, you know, all of your profile data? How would you distinguish that if you were going to put your hang up your shingle as somebody who's going to do this for a living? How would you prove to prospective clients that you're the person that they can trust with their reputation?
Sure.
What do you think about that?
You probably, again, maybe to keep it in the context of a company, you probably first need access to more data. So we need more than just our status updates. We need to know our reputation in terms of, you know, how did we build that PowerPoint presentation? How did we build that spreadsheet? What was our conversation like with a client at a recent meeting? So the more transparent our personal data streams become, the more we give opportunity to these types of services. So how would you hang up your shingles? You probably first need to have a back-end system that can capture new data, not just mine it from what's available on the public web. So I think that the reputation management is going to be a little bit more nuanced than just the public face. It's going to be much more about what we do inside the workplace in our workflows.
Very interesting. All right, so what other jobs might you see coming then that in 2013 or 14 or even a little beyond, that if you were going to advise young people today, you'd say, well, always nice to be a lawyer or a doctor, but have you ever thought about X? What would X be?
Yeah, so I think getting into the world of material science, so there's a big push towards science, technology, engineering, and math, and we are at the very edge of a revolution in material science based on nanoscale materials design, so a billionth of the meter design of everything in our world. And then the other area is this notion of bioindustrialism, so using things like algae and bacteria to assemble molecules into useful materials. So those are two kind of very big growth areas in the material science world. And then the other big area would just be in software. Getting into programming, being able to work with algorithms, being able to work with programming languages and data is a critical kind of skill set for the future of these new jobs.
All right, very good. Gary Golden, professional futurist and forecaster, you can link up to him by going to coasttocoastam.com, link onto his name, and see what Gary is talking about at his GaryGolden.net website. Some very interesting longer form pieces about what's coming, World Wide Web and a web of wisdom or manipulation. I think you're spot on. Actually, I think we talked about it a little bit last year at the Association of Professional Futurists about the difference between data and wisdom. And I really like where you're going with that, and people should be ready for that. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you very much, Ian.
All right, and we look forward to talking with Terry Grimm coming up in just a moment and about the work she's doing with corporations and the future. And then we'll get to your calls coming up in the last hour on Coast to Coast. Now, before we forget entirely, though, about that first hour, if you didn't catch it, I would recommend you use your Coast Insider to go back and listen to two big stories, one of a killer wave, a rogue wave, that just recently took the life of the captain and the chief engineer of a 900-foot tanker. We heard that story from Captain Kelly Sweeney, and it's just one of a many stories that are coming faster and faster about these killer waves afoot in the oceans. Also, we've got a great update on the D.B. Cooper story and what you can expect in 2011. This story, we really firmly believe, will finally be broken and solved by the FBI, finally admitted to by the FBI. Go read about it. Link on it, too, at coasttocoastam.com. Terry Grimm is a futurist, and she's with the Foresight Alliance. We'll talk more about what she sees as what's coming in 2011 and beyond. Then we'll get to your questions for futurists coming up after the top of the hour on Coast to Coast. Making your decisions about your personal prosperity and your what you hope for your kids, for your grandkids, for your community. The future trends, they in many cases are already happening. You may even have seen glimmers about them in TV commercials and wondered, what's that about? Well, we'll tell you what it's all about next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Terry Grimm is also a futurist and somebody who writes and studies what is coming for all of us. Hey, Terry.
Hello.
Glad to add your perspective and particularly a woman's voice on the subject.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me on the show, Ian.
I think it's something we all think about, but we actually do very little about the future. And even the statistics we see with people who haven't begun to plan their retirement until they're 55, you know, 8 years away or something, and they snap into action. And I think that there's a lot of that. I really enjoyed the layout of things on your webpage, Foresight Alliance, how people are the pitfalls that people face in thinking about the future. But as somebody who works as a consultant for businesses, helping to put together strategies and doing research, what do you see as some of the payoffs for future trends you've been watching that are going to be happening in 2011 and things that we can start seeing glimmers of that are coming much more down the road?
Okay. That's a broad question. A lot of different answers. One is we work with clients and really customize looking at the trends and helping them understand some of the surprises. What happens quite often is people get very much tunnel vision, so they're used to looking at their industry and are surprised when things hit them from, you know, the side that they weren't expecting. So we help broaden their view and look at where innovation could come from. I mean, one of the things I like joking about is bagged lettuce. You know, way back, if you had talked to someone about how could you innovate lettuce, you know, and now most of our lettuce is purchased as bagged lettuce. But, you know, there's always innovation possible. It's just looking at some of the trends that are coming and how do you leverage those trends to come up with some new ideas and new ways to do things.
Or another way to talk about that, though, is that we've always had bagged lettuce. It's just the lettuce itself wasn't chopped up. It was
exactly.
Just lettuce in a little bag, and then you take it home. But now bagged lettuce even means a whole other type of product. It's just the salad right before you had all put it in the bowl. And that is an interesting way to do it. For years, people were probably thinking of a way that they have a bag and they've got lettuce. How can we make more money with this bag and this lettuce? And all they need to do is chop it up and seal it.
And charge four times the price.
Right, and charge four times the price for it. All right, so give me an example then of things coming in 2011 that you've been watching for a while, helping corporations either keeping an eye out for it, these innovations, as Joel Barker would say, innovations on the verge.
Well, there's two areas that I personally specialize in. One is helping organizations sort of codify their foresight practices, which is, you know, we've talked a lot about foresight, but one of the basic questions is, you know, how do I do foresight well? How do I know if I'm improving in my foresight practices? You know, the intent is to get better at foresight so you can make better decisions
right. And
make more informed decisions. And so, you know, one of the tools I've come up with, which if you follow the link to the Foresight Alliance, you can actually download it for free, is the Foresight Maturity Model, which goes through our best practices in foresight and helps you measure, you know, how well you're doing in foresight and
okay. You
know, the objective. My background's engineering, so I do not come from the liberal arts like a lot of futurists So it's, you know, I'm very much vested in, you know, how do you get return on investment for what you're doing? How do you make sure that what you're doing as you're, you know, because it takes funds and money and time, that you're going to get a payoff in your foresight work? And so the maturity model helps you make sure that you're doing best practices and can, you know, achieve that result.
Well, what are some of the best practices then for people who want to see that they're going to get a payoff for this? They're going to broaden their view for their company. How do they do that?
Well, and some of the work's based on Dr. Bishop and Andy's best practices in the field. And so it's looking at forecasting and how you acquire a new insight, how you do visioning, how you do planning, how you scan the horizon, and how you frame the question.
Okay.
Framing is usually really important because people ask a question, but they're not asking the right question. You know, one of the traditional answers people give is the beverage industry didn't ask the question about what people were drinking. And so some of the big manufacturers missed the water trend, you know, because they were thinking colas.
Right.
If they had framed the question differently, they would have gotten a different answer.
All right. Okay. Well, that's, again, I'm still trying to get to kind of some nuts and boltsy like ways we can address this for other people who are looking to do that. So give me an example then of ways in which people can look for that to avoid becoming the story that people, you know, talk about with it. They were so busy trying to come up with formulas that they missed the water.
Okay. One is what you're reading. Here's, you know, people usually read trade journals in their industry and only their industry. I teach like the intro course, and one of the things I get people to do is read out of their comfort zone. You know, go pick a magazine that you would never read. You know, like if you're a aging baby boomer, you know, go pick a real trendy magazine that in a million years you wouldn't be caught with, and read it, see what they're saying, you know, and just really read out of your comfort zone, read sort of on the fringe and how that affects your life.
Right. Good. A good way of doing that. For people who they have a small business, a small manufacturing business. What are ways that they can see how they can be better prepared for the future?
There's a lot of different techniques. One is we use a mnemonic called STEEP, which is social, technological, environment, economic, political. So instead of just looking at the industry you're in, look at the whole broader industry. You know, look at what are the social implications of what you're doing? What are the technical implications? Really broaden your view and start looking more holistically at what you're doing and where some of the surprises may come from, and read about some of those trends so you can really start, you know, if you will, scan the horizon, because that's where a lot of changes will come from. It won't come from inside your industry.
It'll come from elsewhere. Fine. So, again, then what do you see things – how do you think things will be then? How different – in what ways will things be different in, say, 2015 from what they're like right now?
Okay. Well, another area that I'm spending a lot of time in, which answers that question, is women as builders of the future.
Okay. Talk about that.
I think there's a premise right now that as women are coming into the workforce in droves, that they will perform like men, and I don't believe that premise. Women, both nature or nurture, have different perspective, and I think what you're seeing, as Gary talked about with some of the millennials and stuff, is more of this collaboration, consensus building, co-partnering, which is very much a women's strength. So I think you're going to see women really making a change in the future that we haven't yet fully appreciated.
Well, Let me amplify that a little bit, because I think that one of the jobs I do in broadcasting involves a very female intensive product, which, you know, especially women as consumers, that's something which is that is a gold mine out there for a lot of companies that they may not until recently have been paying attention to. The number of purchases that are driven now by women within a home used to be, you know, 50-50, you know, the woman had her purview and the guy had his, but now women are much more in charge of almost everything that comes into the home, and they have a big impact even on the purchase of what the car is going to be, or what you know, what's going to be going in the garage or in the basement that they previously had, you know, not been kind of given access to. And so I think that so many companies are reconsidering reaching out to women, but they don't know how. They think of women as being, you know, always like ready to cry, or they need a story about something in order to be able to connect to it. And I think that notion somehow that in order to talk to women, you have to somehow speak pink. I think that is something that we're seeing a lot less of, and I think more and more companies are just basically talking around men and going right to the real decision maker in the household.
I think it's great that you just said that. I just wrote a paper called Beyond Pink.
Right.
If you go to one of my favorite writers, Edgar Schein, he talks about cultural analysis, understanding cultural changes, and I've used his model to create three levels of change that I think you'll see women in. The first one is I call pinking the organization, you know, which is where you make it women friendly. So you have family friendly practices, and, you know, most organizations are at that level. They're, you know, they're inviting to women. The next level is actually empowering women. So it's where you're really championing women as leaders, and listening to them and hearing their voices and stuff. But in a way, you haven't changed the rules of the game. You're still expecting women to compete in a man's world with men as a man would. And the third level is really the transformational level. It's called embracing the feminine. And it's really about understanding the feminine values that women bring, which I think is the whole transformation. You know, we're just on the tip of, and we're going to see more of that, which is understanding this collaboration, this consensus building, a new style of leadership where, you know, it's not so authoritarian. And you need both, so I'm definitely not, you know.
Well, I think the way to look at that is, I mean, some people look at that and go, oh, great, the further Oprahfication of America. And I think that's the mistake of it, to look at that. I think that the power of this this new consumer model and following with women who are obviously, you know, now are dominant in both college educations and now soon to be all master's educations, you know, there will be more of them going to women. Is it that there's somehow that said that women generally, and this is a stereotype, but I think it's generally true, is that women tend to be more focused on the process and less about the outcome. Men tend to be outcome-based, bottom-line thinkers that just say, okay, what do I got to do? Tell me what I got to do so I can go do it. And women tend to be much more focused on how is everybody's voice being heard. Is this going to be a good thing? Are we going to feel proud of it later on? There's more of an emotional attachment to what's actually being done than when men are left alone to do that sort of thing. Am I getting close?
You're exactly on target. There's actually a great book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, which talks about basically biologically women have, over the course of time, been wired differently. So women are wired to react to facial expressions and emotional cues and relationships just as a survival thing, where men are focused differently. So the brain is actually, they've done studies, is you know, is wired very differently.
Yeah, I've interviewed that author, Leonard Schlein, a couple of times. Yeah, I think that's groundbreaking work. And yeah, and that is the... That is something that I think more and more companies are, and I think part of it too is getting over the idea that though that women or that men are defective women, which is the other thing that I think a lot of women have to get over, too, is thinking of men as just being sort of this unfathomable, you know, don't even want to bother with it kind of an entity. And I think there's a problem with that that we're seeing in schools. And I think that's a trend we have to be careful about, where boys are going to become lost boys. That if the school systems or the educational systems are focused on girls, then boys are going to end up where the girls were 25 years ago when they weren't getting an education in math and science like they are now. And the same thing, the boys are going to end up being the new disenfranchised group. And ironically, it will come at the hands of more women who will dominate the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think that anything, there's a balance. You know, the pendulum has gone both ways. It needs to balance, needs both aspects. I think clearly there's times where consensus building isn't the right answer. You know, you need more, rapid decision making. So you need both. It's learning how to live in an environment where you use the best of each when you need it.
Right. How do you see the role of all these social networks in the future in regard to women, technology? There used to be this belief that women were never really going to be online, that it was all, you know, this was a boy toy kind of a thing. And then that obviously is not something that people believe in anymore. But what do you think of as the future of that in the next 4 or 5 years with women, social networks, and the workplace?
Well, you know, again, I'm clearly trying to use the word women, different from feminine, and I distinguish those as women is gender, it's your sex, whereas feminine is a cultural thing, and I think, you know, men can have feminine values. So the networking is clearly relationship building, and I think embraces the feminine value, and IBM just did a study, and I think they found that the more contacts you increase actually brought in revenue of like $900 per person. So they're, you know, starting to increase the number of contacts people make, recognizing that relationship building, you know, brings a bottom line value to the company. So that's really important.
Yeah. You know what, though? You said something there that strikes a note with me, and I don't know if you meant it to sound that way. I think there's a difference for men between networking and relationship building. And I think that men have always been great networkers. And it's really easy for guys to network because their relationships tend to be uncomplicated. But that also tends to make them somewhat superficial relationships. So they're great networkers, but they're not necessarily great relationship builders. And I think that may be the difference maybe between these characteristics we're talking about with some broad brushstrokes between men and women, but that men are learning maybe to have deeper relationships through this technology, but that women could learn to be the networkers that men can be. Because I mean, you can know a million guys, and they're, you know, you kind of feel like you, as a guy, you almost feel like you're growing up kind of in like the League of Justice or something. You don't have this special skill, but you know a guy who does. And everybody knows what skills the other guy has. And I think that too is part of where the future is going, is guys being willing to build these networks and then also maybe even build them a little bit deeper so that they're more than just contacts, more than just names in a Rolodex, but maybe stronger relationships that they can depend on to help bring in work and to, you know, solidify their bottom line.
I think that's true, and I think that's where I see where you need the strengths of both. You know, you need the strengths of men and women, and you know, men have traditionally been, you know, played sports, and you know, a lot of even the business metaphors that people use are all sports metaphors, and women have been left out just because they don't even understand the metaphor. And I think one of the interesting things is looking at some of the online gaming, which is still very much designed by men. I think only 15% of the online games are designed by women. And so there's still a lot of areas where work needs to be done, and And
well, and profits are to be made, too. I mean, if women are out there making these decisions, design the games differently, you find a whole new audience. You're not going to be competing with all the male-dominated games. You'll find some new ones, too, in the future. Thank you, Terry Grimm. Pleasure Foresight Alliance is her website. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. And then we'll get back to your questions and comments. Last hour. And we'll take calls. The trends you're watching, things you see on the horizon, the way in which you think these trends are shaping your future and the future of this country, what are you noticing? We'll talk about that with the futurists next on Coast to Coast. Talking about the deep trends for 2011 and beyond. So what have you been seeing? What are you wondering about? How would you like to see what you want to do turned into a career? Or for that matter, if you've got a business, what are your challenges in terms of what you think the future means for you? Well, that's some really cool issues have come up in the last 2 or 3 hours in this discussion. And we'll get to a bunch more coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Back from the first hour on Coast to Coast AM, when we were talking about the subject of future studies, two people who teach at the University of Houston, Dr. Peter Bishop and Andy Hines, will take your calls about future studies, both as something which we need to do more of, but also what they're seeing as academics and as business professionals, what's going to be coming in 2011 and beyond. We start with Radael in, oh, I think we already had him on just the other day. Let's go to Greg in Oregon. First time caller line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Peter and Andy Hines. Go ahead, Greg.
Good evening, Ian. How are you?
Good. You got a question about the future?
Yeah, actually, I do. I wonder about what you might describe as game changers. The poet Burns put it in a poem to a mouse. We think this is what it's going to be. We do quantitative and qualitative analysis, and then along comes the BPA spill, or as you would put it, you put your foot in a calf, it becomes gamey.
Right.
How does it change your life? So where does this fit into the, I guess, the academic procedures, if you will,
Are you addressing, like, probabilities? Are you trying to get an idea about variables, or?
No, it's what tools you bring to the table.
Okay.
If you're an Edgar Cayce, if you're a Nostradamus, they don't say what are your qualitative and quantitative skills, but within the field of academics, we actually like to see, give me some sense of how you come to this.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you're talking about, right, so methodology.
Is, you know, intuition. Let me put it this way. We have a president, when it came to political science, he was being interviewed, and he said, son, there ain't no science to politics in Texas. And he was the president who followed and assassinated president. So,
all
you know,
right.
That was
Okay, well, let's take it from there. Okay. Dr. Peter Bishop or Andy Hines, either you want to take that question?
Yeah, sure, Ian. Thank you very much for the question, Greg. Where the term we use for game changers, which is kind of a more common term, the term we use is called wild cards. Wild cards are defined as very low probability but very high impact events. And there are, of course, an infinite number of them. There can be wild cards in technology, in environmental issues, in politics, and even in demography and whatever. There is a very little real analysis that goes into wild cards because fundamentally they're a product of our imagination. In future studies, we do logical analysis, extrapolation, particularly in terms of the expected future, but in terms of what might happen instead, we turn to basically causal and logical analysis. Wild cards basically pop up almost out of nowhere. So it's impossible to catalog them all. It's impossible to predict them. But we do refer to them because they are out there. And when they do happen, they do, as you say, change the game and put the future into a different space. 9/11 was such an event, the BP spill, the financial collapse, even the internet itself was a was a kind of a wild card when the World Wide Web came along in the middle 1990s. So that's very much in our thinking, part of what we do. Remember, I said it was the expected future versus the other futures, the alternative futures, and way on the low probability, high impact side are what we call wild cards.
Yeah, Andy, a thought on that?
Well, I guess just to add a little bit to what Peter's talking about, just some examples of some of the discontinuities that we're thinking about heading forward. One would be a breakthrough in life expectancy. Life extension, super longevity. We're looking at things like our fellow futurist Ray Kurzweil talks about the singularity, which is the point at which machine intelligence exceeds human or biological intelligence. Our ecosystem collapse is another one that we're looking at and exploring. So, we do keep track of, what are those potential, really interesting and important alternative futures.
Yeah, he mentioned something, so I'll give it just to I'll get back to the phones right away. So again, we've put the numbers up, and if you need them, they're on the website too. But the I did this really stupid thing the day before Thanksgiving, and I tore every ligament in my ankle, and then I also separated the bones in my ankle. But I kept walking on it because I really thought, okay, it's just a bad sprain, and I'm being a puppy, and I can handle this. And then after about 3 weeks, it really wasn't getting any better. So so I went in, and I was talking about this with my wife because I thought there's kind of three different ways of looking at this. I went in and I followed the protocol of the surgery and then a cast, and then that's supposed to make everything right according to the higher probabilities. But they didn't anticipate that the cast was put on in such a way or something that by the time they took the cast off just a week later, the entire thing was all of my flesh that was inside of the cast was breaking down. And then it was in a severe state of being infected. So in a way, I was healthier before I went to the doctor. And now another doctor's treating the infection, and it's going to be okay again. But it made me think, wow, what, I would have maybe been stuck with a permanent limp, but I wasn't risking losing my foot. I go to a doctor and I get that fixed, and now I'm in the threat of losing a foot, and gangrene is like almost setting in. And I think that's just, to me, that's sort of a model for sometimes how our futures work, because sometimes you do the right thing, the best practices, and you get the wrong outcome. And sometimes you don't do what's expected, and it may prolong your life.
Well, it's the category there, Ian, is what we call unintended consequences. We do things for a purpose, but we have a rule in future studies in our systems thinking courses, you can't do just one thing. So we want people to have homes and home ownership, and all of that was a policy of the federal government, and then that blows up into a huge housing bubble and the financial collapse.
Right.
So
yeah.
You can't do just one thing. So you have to think about other things that will happen in addition to that. Now we've tried to solve the financial collapse, and now we're carrying these huge burden and debt in governments, both in the U.S. and in Europe and places like that. So as Yogi Berra said, it's just one thing after another.
Yeah, that's actually really good. I kind of accept that metaphor of my ankle as the financial collapse. Tom is in Somerville, Massachusetts, on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Peter Bishop and Andy Hines of the University of Houston Futures Studies Program. Tom?
How are you? In terms of actually having a future, in a sense, the concern between male and female relationships is delusional, because if we are unable to deal with cruel forces, we're not going to have any future. Now, that's a complicated thing to get into, but
yeah.
A certain aspect of it is bad government. We usually take government as, well, that's the government. But there's such a thing as bad government. And in terms of the future, we really have to get into the study of what good government is and who should be in it. That's what I have to say.
That's an interesting thought. Now, let's go back to cruel forces. I like how he describes that, because I think that's something we all sort of experience, but I don't know how I would categorize it. Andy, anything?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess one of the things that sparked when I heard that idea is a lot of,
before I spent about 10 years working as a futurist inside, you know, large companies, and I think the perception I had going in was that, you know, the big companies are you know, inherently, you know, out to do bad things, and, you know, this, I think we hear the same thing about government, you know, they're not, you know, the motives are often questioned. And my experience coming out the other side was, you know, for the most part, I think organizations, large organizations, are trying to do the right thing, but it's just structurally, it's very difficult. And like Peter mentioned, our systems thinking course, and you know, our tendency is to want to sort of you know, blame the behavior of the people, but often it's the structure of the system that leads to these outcomes that you know, we might call cruel forces.
Yeah, I think cruel forces is an interesting concept. I'd have to spend some more time thinking about that. But even on the idea of good government versus no government, or bad government as opposed to just accepting bad government as the government, there is, I think, maybe a sense of people feel like they don't have a stake in the future because they don't feel like they can ever be fully represented in a system that's this large. And I get that. I mean, I think there is kind of a disconnect on that, but let's leave that for now. Well, Cody, Peter, do you have some?
Yeah, the concept of cruel forces, I agree, is an interesting one. There are forces, and there are causes. Very few, you know, nothing happens by itself. Everything is caused. Whether that force is cruel or not, it depends on your perspective. So the government is bad for some people, but it's good for others. And the system itself is what it is, and that's what we're trying and do, that the system itself is not bad. The system either evolved or is designed to produce the behaviors that we see. If you want to create change, you have to agree with the caller. You have to change the system. You can't just change the people. So forces that are cruel for some people may actually be quite beneficial for others.
Talking about how do you study the future and what can we learn of the future that we might see in 2011 and beyond, how we can be prepared for these changes coming up. Brett is in Syracuse on Coast to Coast. Brett?
Oh, how are you doing, sir? I'm a longtime listener, and I'm actually first-time caller on the Wildcard line. I always listen to your show on my way home from work. I'm a live sound man sound engineer for bands and everything, and I actually am back in the job market because the main venue I worked at is at its last show tonight.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. So you're kind of looking for maybe for what your future is going to be like. So how this might apply to you?
One big thing I wanted to tie it in with is the women and men aspect and how they differ. And it's I really feel like I picked up a lot of traits from my mother growing up, who was like a second grade teacher for 30 years. I find I have a pretty good ability to connect with all sorts of different types of people. I also do like AV installations for professional businesses and everything. And being able to, it's pretty much like in poker, you can read someone and knowing how to conduct yourself and interact with them in a way that is the best, you know, delivers the best connection. Between, you know, the exchange of ideas is a lot better that way. And sometimes people think it's almost like being a bit of a chameleon, and they kind of feel that that's like a...
like something dishonest or something? Yeah.
Yeah, because they think that you, lack a defined, you know, identity of yourself or, you know, but the thing is, I never sacrifice my personal values to please another person or you know... show off or
No, I think you got a good skill there if you're talking about being a chameleon, although that obviously has a pejorative connotation to it. The idea of being adaptive, though, you could say it that way, you're very adaptive. And that's
it is a lot of thinking on your feet, but I definitely think it's empathy is the biggest thing that has gotten me the farthest in any of any of that. And I think it's kind of the term more of a feminine trait, but
It sometimes is. Well, let's run that by, and good luck with you in your job search, Peter and Andy. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit toward the end of the last half hour about about the different defining characteristics of women in the job marketplace and also as consumers versus men, and how that's something that many companies are just becoming aware of, and for that matter, many workers are becoming aware of, and how that reflects also with social networking, et cetera. But that empathy concept, I think that's true, that this tends to be more associated with women. Peter or Andy, do you want to comment on the gender differences?
Yeah, I'd like to take a stab at that, because, you know, one of the running jokes I have in some of the talks I give is, you know, gentlemen, get in touch with your feminine side. And the idea there is, you know, if you look at the feminine characteristics versus masculine, and that, you know, they can be in men or women, but the empathy, the networking, relationship building, all the characteristics, feminine characteristics, are evolutionarily better suited for the emerging economy than the masculine. The typical hierarchy, command and control kinds of, follow the leader kinds of characteristics are on the way out. So in a way, you know, we say the feminine characteristics are better adapted for the way the future is unfolding. So, I think our caller, at least in that respect, is heading in the right direction
there. Yeah. Peter?
Yeah, this fits into a larger theme that I talk about in terms of the emergence of technology. And, of course, we're dealing with digital technology today. And what's happening is that any job or any career that has a lot of routine in it, and frankly, that's most of the jobs in the last two centuries, factory jobs and office jobs, those are turned over to machines more and more. And so what do people do for livelihood and for work in the future is the uniquely human things, the things that the machines can't do, which is exactly what Brett's talking about and what Andy's talking about, relationships, problem solving, leadership, responsibility, teamwork, collaboration, all of those things. We can have a machine do all the accounting for us, but working with others and solving new kinds of non-routine problems is what the future of work is about. So I think Brett's on exactly the right track, using his human skills and emphasizing those, because sooner or later, most of the audio technical stuff will be done by a machine.
Yeah. I made this distinction with Terry, and I really believe in it. I think that there is a line between networking and relationship building. I think men are natural networkers. I think they're really good at networking. I know a buddy. I know a guy. That's just networking. And they may not put the kind of same polish to it that they may learn to do professionally, but I think networking comes easy to men because their relationships tend to be very uncomplicated in a professional sense. And again, we're dealing with stereotypes here a bit, but I do think that's important to point out. I think that men are learning to be better relationship builders, and that it's that relationship that will pay off over time, a little bit more like the mafia. We think about the mafia was really, they were great into relationship building. It wasn't just networking. You guys were, they were all in it together. I mean, they were all going to go, just like being like pirates, really are great relationship builders, but they weren't necessarily great networkers. All right, let's get one other quick thing here before the bottom of the hour. Judy is not too far away from Peter or Andy. She's in Houston, Texas, not far away from the University of Houston and their Future Studies program. Judy?
Hello. My gosh, it's wonderful you brought up about the Italian side of the equation, that kiss sometimes means something else.
Yeah.
Maybe not something in a positive vein.
True.
Gentlemen, I appreciate that you have the show going on, but why can't you get a little more sophisticated in your how you're communicating? The gentleman that talked about the government, you know, that's definitely a draconian and Machiavellian type of style, which is actually, filtered down into American business. And
I'm trying to accept your criticism, but I got to say, I don't quite understand it. So you're saying
you're
not being...
You see, what my this gentleman, it seemed like when he called it, was trying to latch on to what that phraseology might have been for him to be able to feel, you know, as though it's... There is an actual word for this kind of behavior, you know, immoral type things going on in government, et cetera. But okay. what my point I really wanted to make is, if you
well,
would,
you got to make it real quick here because we're just
almost
out of time.
I'll make it really fast. Is that with the dumbing down of American education, everybody has to realize, look at your superintendents across the school systems and see that they're former military. See that everybody is being in a situation where they're being guided to serve in the military, and if they don't have the acumen, the intellectual acumen to go to college,
I'm out of time. I'm sorry. I just got to go. I gave you as much as I could there to get to that point, Judy, but God bless you. We can try to filter out that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We'll grab a number right now. We'll get to your question about the future and what you see as trends. I'm kind of curious to see, maybe there's not a lot of people who are future watching the way that others are, kind of intuitively sort of picking up on trends and going, huh, that's interesting. I wonder if. So if you've been picking up on a trend lately, at least one that you see happening, let's run that by the experts, people who do that for a living, trend watchers, futurists, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's get back to the phones for Dr. Peter Bishop and Andy Hines, both teachers of the Futures Program at the University of Houston, talking about the future, both the immediate and one a little further down the line. Joe is in Danville, California, on Coast to Coast. Joe?
Hi. Happy New Year.
And
I was
you.
Wondering. Thank you. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the secretive / shadow governments of our country and others. What you see happening with that?
Okay. Well, I don't know. That so seems a little out of the topic, but okay. So I'll just throw it up to Peter, Andy. Anybody want to comment on the power behind the power in this country, and the idea of transparency, I think, is something that comes up a lot when we talk about government.
Sure. The we've already referred to our systems thinking course, which basically tries to look underneath the surface at how things happen and what the system is that's producing it. The other course that we have of a more theoretical nature is called social change, and that's a course in which we review all of the various historical and contemporary mega theories of why things change and how things change. One of those, of course, is the concept of the power elite, that a few people are really have lots of influence and the rest of us are more or less the recipients of the changes that they create. That's one of a dozen different theories that we review in that course. So, yes, there could be a shadow government, and clearly some people have more influence on the future and social change than anybody else. Whether that is the dominant theory is, of course, an assumption which we entertain, and it can create certain scenarios, but it is not taken as an absolute fact in our program.
I guess that's the question, is do we take it as an assumption or a fact? And I think as an assumption, I think that's very interesting. How does that change the way we approach our government or our relationship with the government? And do you have a thought on that?
Well, one of the back to the values trends you've been talking about a little bit earlier is one of the trends that we see is while formal participation in the political process has been going down, what people have done instead is look for, you know, we're sort of emphasizing the single issue interest. So if I'm really passionate about something, rather than going through the formal channels to you know, deal with it that way, I start my own advocacy group. I form an online community, and, you know, I kind of work outside the system. So, you know, political participation, while, again, maybe going down formally, is actually going up, but it's been happening outside the system.
Oh, interesting. So when we talk about then outside the system, meaning online chat rooms, people who form more insulated groups in which they express those opinions as opposed to challenging the system itself.
Yeah, not only expressing opinions, but getting things done. I mean, you know, mobilizing large numbers of people is a lot easier now. And, you know, if you want to get, you know, people want to get something done, we call them the consumer vigilantes, you know, groups that can, you know, mobilize really quickly and powerfully and use tools to get things done. And like I said, it's easier to get it done outside the system sometimes.
You know, I see that. I think flash mobs are an interesting reflection of that, right? So that they can set it all up in advance, and in a very public space, suddenly everybody shows up and does this joyous thing, which is intending to create sort of shockwaves of humor and smiles that then go out from that. And there's no necessarily any central authority that created that. It's just people deciding this is what they need at the food court at the mall at noon today. Right. I like that. Let's go to Aaron, who's in California on Coast to Coast and a first-time caller line for Peter and Andy of the University of Houston's Futures Studies Program. Aaron?
Yes. Hi guys. I can't believe I got through. My question is, the trend I've been noticing, and I wonder what your thoughts were on that, was on this, with the real estate market hitting a crisis in terms of the rapid appreciation of homes getting to a point where they're not affordable by people, and people have to go really far into debt to get them, and the excessive printing of money that we have, which is where we don't have anything, any commodities or anything backing up our monetary right. system. With all these things coming together, do you see a reorganization of our economic structure in the future?
Yeah, great question.
One of the ways we've approached that in our consulting business is a lot of clients, when the recession first hit, they came to us and said, help us, how is this going to play out? And the technique we use is scenario planning, scenario thinking, where we look at the different, plausible outcomes and then just try to track the indicators that suggest which way we're heading. A couple of the main patterns that we looked at. One, I think popular we hear called the double dip, right? So one is we try to put some Band-Aids on the current system. The Band-Aids don't work, so we have to try again, but go at a much deeper level. A less likely but potentially getting more and more reasonable every day is, kind of a new Bretton Woods where we have to re-envision the whole system. And so we help clients, to kind of look at those different possibilities and then say, which way do we seem to be tracking?
Peter?
One of the most interesting questions that comes up in our course is that everybody realizes that capitalism has been an enormously beneficial system, an economic system for the last couple of centuries, primarily for North American, European, Japanese, and other countries coming on now, but that it itself is probably going to change as everything does. Another rule we have in our systems course is that nothing goes on forever. And yet I challenge students to think, well, what would come after it? How would you actually rethink about an economic system that wasn't socialism, that wasn't fascism, that wasn't feudalism, that wasn't capitalism? What's another economic system? And frankly, I have a hard time, and they have a hard time coming up with an alternative system. I think what Andy's saying is that we continue, when we are faced with problems, as we have in this economic system, we want to try and take the path of least resistance. We want to try and kind of tweak things and then go on as we did before. That works sometimes, but then other times it doesn't, and then we have to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And so when do we get to a fundamental change and a fundamental solution to the economic systems that cause the problems that we just had, which is increasing bubbles and collapses and recessions and things like that? And that's what scenarios are for. How deep does it go before we come up with a new system?
Well, I think here I would make a proposal that the new system is actually what the original system was supposed to be like. And it goes back to what Andy was talking about in the first hour in his research about the emergence of these new values. And the valueless-based capitalism, I think, is the problem. That it was never intended to be valueless, or that it was supposed to just say, well, whatever happens, happens. There was a belief that there was supposed to, there's sort of an assumption that there was a core morality to one's capitalization. And so capitalism works best when, and it doesn't have to be a, Judeo-Christian set of morals or values, but if capitalism works best when it's done, I think, on a smaller scale, and the people are connected to the investments, it's a little bit like It's a Wonderful Life. Right at the beginning, when the run is on at the bank across the street, and then the run comes on the savings and loan, and when you all break it back down into people, then suddenly the value of the money is more than just what it is in your hand. It's what it represents to the other people around you. And I think that's when it gets better.
As you well know, Ian, Adam Smith, who obviously laid out described the emerging capitalist system and is considered one of the founders and theoreticians, he wrote The Wealth of Nations, which was his book on capitalism. He also wrote the book on human sentiments, which was his basically laying out the distinctions between psychology and culture and values and things like that. And there is a continuous tension in society between our economic interests, which has us being competitive and aggressive and using and growing and whatever, and our cultural systems, which has us raise children and participate in religion and be good citizens and things like that. There is a tension between those, and at various points in history, one will be dominant over the other. And it's right now a discussion about whether our capitalist system has enough values associated with it to be able to be supportive of society in general, or just for a few who happen to be good at playing that game.
Well, I think that's what it comes down to, then. It's the tension between the Adam Smith model and the Ayn Rand model. And what we've seen at the top is that Randians have dominated our economic playbook. And they thought that people would be different when given the opportunity, and they're not. And so I think that it's okay to have values and to talk about values in association with capitalism. I think that may be a new vogue. That may just be me. But Mike is on a wild card line, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on Coast to Coast for Peter and Andy, futurists at the University of Houston. Mike?
Hi, how you doing?
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, all right. The question I had was, do they see life coaching or mentoring as a possible career in the near future?
Well, it's been one of the past. What will be the future of life coaching? Andy, Peter?
Well, certainly. And you know, what's interesting about that is, like we talked earlier about the emerging job titles. And when you think about some of the things that are, you know, personal trainers, personal shoppers, I don't know, personal concierges, there's whole new job titles and almost, you know, mini industries, if you will, emerge that 20 or 30 years ago, if you had brought that up, people would have thought you were crazy. And I think, you know, certainly the idea of, you know, life coaching is already, you know, certainly out there. It's the kind of thing that, you know, as Peter talked about earlier, is, you know, the new jobs of the future are around the human skills. And so something like life coaching and career coaching and things like those become the needs of the future. So I would certainly put that as one of the categories that we've identified long ago and we see continuing.
I know a couple of people who are former life coaches already. They've been through the cycle. Really? I know. I just had a conversation with one the other day. He's looking at a second career. Liked doing it, but there isn't anything, like, you don't see somebody coming and going, hey, what's the name of your life coach, or hey, I've got a great life coach for you. It's still too exotic, and there isn't necessarily an ROI on it. And so that's part of the idea too about even going back to the how will the personal the internet, you know, reputation manager, how will they be compensated? How do you define what that's worth in such a way, you know, that it really becomes something that's profitable for somebody to pay for and somebody else to do for a living? All right, let's go to let me get to Pat on the first time caller line in Iowa for Peter and Andy. Pat?
Hi, good morning. Hi, my question really has to do with outsourcing. What's the future of that, and how is that going to benefit Americans? You know, like they talk about the
right
middle class diminishing.
Sure. What about the future of outsourcing, Peter? Andy?
Yeah. This is, of course, a contemporary issue of our time, but it's also been an historical issue. The U.S., of course, was the low cost producer
compared to the European industries in the 19th century, and we are now the country with the most amount of money, and therefore we are basically hiring workers from around the world to do a lot of the jobs that either people here do not want to do or couldn't afford to do. And so it's a continual rollout. This is really what capitalism, what success is bringing more people into the economic system that we have been benefited from all of this time. Unfortunately, as the caller points out, the competition is with people in those middle-class jobs, those routine jobs, those jobs that our parents and our grandparents raised us, and they were great jobs. But now those jobs are going either into machines, as I pointed out before, or they're going overseas. So as we've been talking about, we have to therefore move up the value chain in terms of human skills, personal service, the design, the creative parts of work, where the others around the world, the 3 or 4 billion people coming onto the workforce, so we simply can't compete with them on a dollar per dollar, hour per hour basis. So we have to find a way of being competitive and allow them to do the jobs that we did in the 20th century. Our jobs in the 21st century have to be something different. I don't think we can compete with them.
Andy?
Well, one counter trend to think about in relation to that is near sourcing, where organizations are finding, while certainly there are some cost-saving benefits from putting some jobs, like Peter had mentioned, overseas to cheaper labor, that there are also savings by, you know, in the case of physical goods, of not having to ship, as well as building relationships.
Okay. All right. Let me get another caller in here real quickly. We're winding down. Hey, Jesse, who's on East of the Rockies right now? Okay, let me get to Frank in Texas on Coast to Coast for Peter and Andy. Frank?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I want to discuss your topic earlier about a replacement for our current monetary system. There's something out there called a resource-based economy. It's promoted by the Venus Project and the Zeitgeist Movement. And
okay.
I think it has a very good value set that can replace the greed and corruption of our current capitalist system.
Are you referring to my model I laid out for an alternative currency in how we could move our current denominations in the United States to M&Ms? Is that what you're talking about, what we were talking before about capitalism?
The capitalism.
Okay, just checking on that.
The monetary system and its insolvency over time.
Don't rule out my idea of using M&Ms as currency, because really it works. If you sit down with it, the whole system works. Interesting. I wish we had more time to explore that. That is a whole other topic in itself. Let me go to David in Yellow Springs, Ohio, on Coast to Coast, as our time is winding down with Peter and Andy, futurists at the University of Houston. The Future Studies Program, by the way, worth looking into. You can find out more information online. David?
Yes, Ian, I guess I don't have time to do what I really want to do. You were involved with a wild card situation yourself. I'll talk to you about it on another day, having to do with Y2K. Think about where you were that morning, the morning after. But as far as your guests are concerned, I can't remember which one of you made the comment about audio engineers being replaced by machines. I don't know how much you know about audio engineering, but ain't going to happen, I can tell you that much. There's too much subjective, nuanced, intuitive kind of things that go into the aspect of running audio engineering for, like, nightclubs, recording sessions, whatever. Sessions are not that one.
All right, you may be right on that. All right, so Peter and Andy here, just the 30, 40 seconds we have left, and sorry we couldn't get everybody on the air. What do you think, what's the one thing you think we should be looking out for coming up in 2011? What moment will be your I told you so moment in 2011? Peter?
Well, as you know, Ian, 1 year forecasting is not our strength. So in 2011, I don't know. I do believe that we're going to be surprised by the developments, the continued developments of the world's economy. And if I were thinking of a wild card, I would be concerned about sovereign debt, the debts that governments are taking on.
I think that's an excellent answer. Andy, how about you?
I think I'd be looking at something around consumer confidence, consumption patterns, And, you know, are we going back to business as usual? I don't think that's likely. Or have some of the shifts we're already seeing starting to happen gaining some strength?
Perfect. Thank you so much. Dr. Peter Bishop, University of Houston, Andy Hines. Couldn't ask for a better last hour. Terrific questions from everybody out there, too. Thank you so much. Looking forward to 2011 either way, and 2015 for that matter, too. Deus te amat, and I do, too.